Well, I'm sorry we haven't got any vacancies for you at present, and I can only wish you all the best in the future. That's different, sir. You can start on Monday.
Join the Masons. It says more about you than American Express ever can.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 7th of February, 2025. Streaming live once more from the Eastone Studios in Bristol, one of several Templar ports in the Empire, as it now is, of lies, of mass media, mind control, folks, and spin. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. No longer, I'm afraid. And also, apparently, that's one of the reasons why we've got... we're not on Apple Podcasts anymore, because James had been doing that, and he's no longer doing it. So you just have to come... either come back to the thisweek.org.uk page and follow the links there, download it later, or you can come on live to the talkradio.org.uk stream. But it is on at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and of course on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which all round is really the best option, I think, and which is available free from the Apple Store or APK Pure, but not from Google Play, because Google are evil, as we know, and stop anything decent happening on there, as they've done with Telegram and people like that. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade zero-trust agenda, bending minds with its sophisticated distortions, or boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes. Well, more on that tonight. One of the heroes, in my mind, is Johnny Vedmore. Hatchet jobs on him. All sorts of nastiness going on. We'll be hearing a bit more about that. We had an interview with Johnny last week, some more on that this week. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against World War III and wage slavery. So for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, so-called solutions to these various crises, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, etc., the Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. Isn't that clever of them? And the politicians have nothing to say. More tonight on Nick Land and his techno-behaviourist dark enlightenment. The cowards and control freaks see us as slaves to their AI. And meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British people as well as on China, Russia and the BRICS, given half a chance. So, it's not the end of the world, or is it? As we learn, you learn. So, helping us navigate the accelerationist WEF fourth right matrix, tonight is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, Bristol-based freelance journalist Joe Banks, and also Bristol-based activist, originally from New Zealand, Matt O'Brannan. So, we're going to have a look in part one at the announcement about small modular reactors. Is this really going to happen or not? And in part two, a very good look using our friend John Bosnich from New Brunswick and Serbia to talk about Canadian politics particularly, but also a lot more besides. Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartels. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and from PRSC by the trans lobby, but not cancelled here yet. Anyway, welcome, Joe. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
And the reason you're in here is just some amazing coincidence has happened this week. You have brought out this article about Israeli funding for a major development here in Bristol, at the same time as Donald Trump has sort of pulled away the curtain to show the Wizard of Oz, which is a Gaza property developer. So what is the, first of all, what's going on in Bristol? This is the Bristol's tallest building, I believe, which has got planning permission.
This is a 28-storey purpose-built student accommodation block, which is going to be built alongside an 18-storey, what's called co-living, which is this new housing product that's similar, very similar to student accommodation, but it's aimed at young professionals. So you've still got smaller space standards than normal residential.
So you say smaller, but how do these compare to a shoebox?
Well, I mean, they're shoeboxes, and then the idea is that you have some communal amenity space on each floor. Although, interestingly, the developer for this scheme recently put a planning application into the planning department, trying to get rid of the communal amenity space and put in more beds, which is a sort of a classic developer thing that they get planning permission and then they try and, you know, maximise the beds and cut out nice things like balconies and stuff like that.
Well, they buy the real estate or they get an option on the real estate, the land itself. Then they try and build up as high as they can and cram as many in per floor. So how does this fit into the operations of Bristol University? Because it definitely seems to be part of their business model. They want to expand as much as possible. We've got now whole units around me in St. Paul's which are just devoted to Chinese students, and there doesn't seem to be any students from any other nationality in these blocks.
So there's been this massive expansion of the universities by around 50% in the last decade. A lot of that is driven by overseas students who the universities like because their fees aren't capped, unlike domestic students. So overseas students in Bristol, Of the two universities, University of Bristol and the University of West of England, overseas students make up around a quarter of the student population at the moment. But the University of Bristol is aiming to have that figure up to about 40% by the end of the decade.
I don't know if this is part of your remit, Joe, but my question has got to be, are the... because they're getting more money from the... foreign students and the domestic British students, are they sort of opening the gates more to the foreign students? Are they making it more difficult for the domestic students to get into the university?
I don't think they're making it more difficult for them, but they're definitely making it easier for the overseas students. And the national government made it much easier and appealing in 2019 when Boris Johnson's government relaxed visa rules and, you know, saying that you could stay on and get a job and making it easier for dependents to come over as well. So you had a massive jump in the numbers around then, and they've at the beginning of 2014 they tightened that up again. But basically what's happened is you've got this massive expansion of the student population in cities that already have housing crises.
Yes, well, we certainly do have that. But yeah, Before we get onto that, the size of these flats, how does that all work? I mean, surely... I mean, if you go back to the 1920s, 1930s, council housing, for example, somebody sat down and said, well, we're going to build some houses, we don't want to make them mansions, but this is the minimum people need. And a lot of the council housing that's still here from the 1930s has got reasonably large living rooms, hallways, kitchens, and this is not... This seems to be now eroded. Even for flats that people are paying for now, seem much smaller. I mean, I've been to some of these just out of curiosity, and you see, for example, lots of mirrors put up in the rooms in order to try and make them look bigger than they really are. So how does this regulation of how big a flat needs to be to make it livable and not drive the resident mad?
Well, it's... I mean, for this scheme, I know that they've... I mean, because the other thing is that with this co-living product... You know, they don't. Local authorities like Bristol don't actually have any guidance yet on it. They're still putting that together, even while these things are getting permission and getting built. Obviously the developers want to cram in as many punters as they can.
Have they just torn up the rule book? Are there special rules for these student flats? And are the co-living ones also?
They're in a different asset class, so they don't have to abide by the same regulations as build to rent flats.
Right, so they're saying their students are going to be in here, so we can have tiny little rooms.
And, yeah.
Yeah, all right, okay. So, yeah, anyway, so how does this fit in with the housing,
the housing crisis, which
is very big in Bristol? Apparently, the property, one of the highest prices for property outside London.
Yes, it is the least affordable city now outside London. So I start off my piece, you know, with this... The image of so where these towers are going to be built is on St James Barton Roundabout, in the city centre of Bristol, and if you go into that sunken concrete plaza called the Bear Pit, in the middle of that roundabout, all winter you've seen you know up to a dozen tents sometimes, homeless people living there, and if you go out. For outside, and you see tents. I mean, you see tents all over the city centre. But you go outside the city centre, and you've got hundreds of people living in vans and caravans. It's just absolutely palpable. I mean, the housing crisis.
I'd say something even going up to thousands of people in vans. I mean, there are four or five very large sites now. One was nearly evicted on Monday this week. The gasworks in Loch Lee's site. There is about 80 caravans, about 100 people on that one site, and that was one that hardly anyone knew about because it was tucked away and had been in there for years. So there's another one near the big Tesco's at Eastfield, the 24-hour Tesco's, a massive site near there, over 100 caravans. So this is becoming, the only option for many people, rather than sleeping on the streets. If they're evicted, they can't afford anywhere to put a roof over their head, is they simply get a caravan and live in there.
Yeah, and you've got a council housing waiting list that's now over 22,000 households. So all these different elements... playing in with each other, and you've also got private landlords leaving the private rented sector, and then you've got all these students coming into the competing with everyone else for housing, but the people that this suits is the people who are building purpose built student accommodation, and the investors who are putting the money in, because you've got this massive, supply and demand imbalance, and you can as well as building residential buildings that have to comply to the same standards. You can also charge huge rents, and the rents for purpose built student accommodation in Bristol are the highest outside of any city outside London.
Do you know how much they are?
It's in the article. I think it's around. It's around 350 a week, I think, is the average.
Right. So they're really looking at how much rent we can get for how much floor space, and then they're trying to cram in as many people as possible. Aren't the students actually quite pleased to have somewhere to live in the city centre?
Yeah, they may be. There aren't many options. I mean, I can't believe that they're happy to be paying so much rent,
in a way, it's not them that's paying it. They're borrowing the money from someone else to pay it, aren't they? And it seems to be the business model here, is they know that people will need someone, and they just kind of, we'll take it as a student loan, and they're not really thinking too much about paying it back in the long term, but they know they can actually stay there for a while. Mm. They're building up debt into the future. They're setting up a debt trap for themselves, in a way.
Yeah.
The company that's private equity real estate investor, Kane International.
Yeah, I mean, so I was looking at this development and just thinking about, this proliferation of student blocks. It's now, it's going to be the tallest building ever in Bristol. It's going to be a student block. They're popping up everywhere, all over the city. So I was looking at that and looking at who, where and what, as well as the student accommodation, the co-living, these build to rent blocks, the sort of property led regeneration model that's changing cities is corporate landlords and institutional investors. So I'm looking at who is the investor in this particular scheme. And it turned out that it's so you've got Kane International, who are a kind of a global, I mean, London headquartered, but a global private equity investment firm, whose CEO is Jonathan Goldstein, who was really a powerful, influential figure in the Israel lobby as chair of the Jewish Leadership Council, which is the umbrella organization for all the various Jewish community charities and institutions.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because they're not really all of the Jewish charities and institutions. It's the most pro-Israeli state, yes, and pro-Zionist ones. There, yeah, are a few around that are Jewish-led, but very anti-Zionist. This, I would presume, the Jewish Leader Council. Do you know anything about this lot, Martin? Jewish Leadership Council?
Not offhand, no. I'm aware that these kind of organisations exist, but I haven't really looked into it in any detail.
Anyway, he's had this chap, Jonathan Goldstein, went on a trip to Israel. Well, I suppose he would, wouldn't he, if he's part of the Jewish Leadership Council, Joe?
Yeah, so he was chair from 2017 to 2022. And in 2017, he went on a trip to Israel. He met people like Gilad Erdan, who was then Minister of Strategic Affairs in Netanyahu's government, and went on to be the ambassador. Sort of, we've become familiar with him now as the ambassador to the UN during the assault on Gaza, and as Minister of Strategic Affairs, one of his responsibilities was to basically fight the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And yes, and his ministry, they're doing things like they were managing Shai Massot, who was the official at the London Israeli embassy who was caught in the Al Jazeera undercover investigation.
Oh, the sting. Yeah, so he was political. Well, I mean,
it wasn't really a sting because, you know, they weren't. He was just recorded, you know, yeah, having private conversations. And what emerged was that he was trying to establish a group called Young Labour Friends of Israel. And he was recorded, you know, having conversations talking about trying to take down British MPs like Alan Duncan, who had been, you know, who's been very outspoken about.
Yeah, he was a minister about actually, the settlements, wasn't he? About the settlements. He was an armed forces minister at the time.
He was in the Foreign Office.
Yeah.
But anyway, he was being managed by this ministry, and so Goldstein is an interesting figure. Also, because he started out as a high flying solicitor, but went into both property development and investment, and the senior points of the of those Jewish leadership structures in Britain through his relationship with a guy called Gerald Ronson. Who was a property, or who is a property developer himself, and established this this company. He took over his father's company in the 60s, which was a furniture business, and turned it into a global property development business, and he owned lots of petrol stations. And by the early 80s, Heron was one of the UK's largest companies. But he also went to prison for the Guinness share trading fraud. He'd actually started in the 60s. This is all in his autobiography. But in the 60s, he was running sort of street fighting anti-fascist groups. And that morphed in, there were various organisations, but that basically over the years has morphed into the Community Security Trust, which is one of the charities that's underneath that JLC umbrella. And they produce reports on anti-Semitism, and they advise the Home Office, and they get government funding. But he's very tied, has very strong ties to Israel.
Well, we're going to be talking to Matt O'Brannan later on, and I wonder whether the sort of thing they might have been talking to the Home Office about would be whether or not a march should go near a synagogue. Interesting, isn't it, that this is the same chap that's behind this massive development here in Bristol City Centre, which is, they, I suppose, would see it as groundbreaking, that they're managing to cram more people into a smaller space than ever before.
Yeah, yeah. Kane International, they do ultra luxury stuff. No, but this is the thing, because currently they've got a project, a $5 billion project called One Beverly Hills, which is this just like 17, I think it's like a 17-acre site. And it's, you know, massive hotels and clubs and for the ultra ultra wealthy, and they're doing the same kind of property developments in the oil rich Gulf states. So, but they're also part of their strategy is to pile into student accommodation because the returns are so fantastic and it's such a safe and secure investment. But just back on Joel Ronson, and that when he was in prison, he was in Ford Open Prison in West Sussex in 1990. He was fined £500 million and given a 1 year sentence. He served 6 months. But when he was in there, he received a supportive phone call from the then Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, and had a when he was out on a day release one day for a medical examination, he had a personal meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, who was in Shamir's government at the time. He was a minister in Shamir's government, and Ronson is on. There's a handwritten list of donors from Netanyahu's 2007. Election campaign, and it's a list of potential major donors to his campaign, and Joel Ronson's on that. So, yeah.
Ronson and the Guinness case sounds interesting. From a guest we had a long, long time ago, Rowan Bosworth Davis, he was a fraud squad officer in the Met in the late 80s and early 90s, and he explained to us how the message came down from on high in the early 1990s, no more prosecution of fraud. So this would be around about the same time as the Guinness case. And the reason for that was that the Treasury and the government at the time, that would be the major government, had decided that fraud could potentially be good for London and good for Britain in that there would be greater profits for the banks, and if you could get away with it, you could do it. So it may be that Ronson was involved in one of the last proper prosecutions of these sorts of crimes that's ever happened in this country. Interesting that he's there at the forefront of this organization now,
and after prison his business collapsed, but he was propped up with massive loans from people like Rupert Murdoch, Bill Gates, so he prospered, and
he's in the clique.
He was made a knight.
The clique
last year.
Yeah, so he's in the clique.
He was a great mentor to Goldstein. Yeah, but he's been very influential, and Goldstein was very prominent as well when he was chair of the JLC, very prominent in the attacks on Corbyn. You know, around 2018, 2019. During that period.
I mean, this sounds to me almost like a political tower block we've got by the James Barton roundabout being built.
Political in the sense?
Well, in the sense that the people behind it have a certain political bent and they've managed to really tear up any of the regulations to stop them making their money.
Yeah, I mean, it's capitalism.
So does this plan... it has planning permission now, yes,
it's
or
got
not?
Planning permission, yep. So it's on the site. There was a Premier Inn hotel there that they got on with starting to demolish it almost straight away. So they're now taking that down floor by floor. But the other thing, so you've got Kane International, who are this private equity firm, but they are also partnering with an Israeli asset manager called Menorah Mitvagim on their whole portfolio of. You know, purpose-built student accommodation projects all over, you know, in Russell Group University cities all over the country. And if you go to the website Who Profits, which exposes companies' involvement in Israel's military-industrial complex, there's quite a lot on Menorah Mitvagim in there. They have helped finance projects in the occupied territories, the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and they help finance the city of training bases, the IDF city of training bases, in the Negev Desert.
So what's that? City of training?
City of training.
Sort of, I mean, I know on Salisbury Plain there's a place we always used to call Tin City, which was where the army would train. So what's the city of training?
Well, it's where the IDF train. I mean, I don't think it's because there's one. They've got one training base where which is incredible, where they've built, a replica of Gaza. You know, and that's where they.
Is there anything of it left?
Well, there's more of that left, I think. Yeah, but you know, and they've got Palestinian murals around, and it's supposed to be a mock-up. I think that's nearer the border of Gaza, but this is just an enormous, it's an enormous military complex in the south of Israel.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk a bit more about Mitvagim in a minute, but Martin, I don't want to skip over this very important connection, which is to the removal of Jeremy Corbyn, also. Things like the funding of David Lammy's campaign, the Bilderberger, to be the Labour candidate for Mayor of London in 2015. And of course,
Goldstein funded that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's obviously a political organisation here, Israeli, pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist, pro-Israeli state. Netanyahu's actually best buddies with them. And they're also involved in the campaign to destroy Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, I mean, obviously the nitty-gritty detail has been outlined to us, but it's not surprising, is it? We know that these kind of people exist and that they have a very, you know, powerful voice behind the
scenes.
Does
it matter? I mean, this is just money, really, isn't it?
No, it does matter. I mean, ultimately, if we're going to have boycott, disinvestment and sanctions, which I think we should on Israel, then things like this, you could say, well, we're not going to take your money. I mean, you know, we don't want you investing in our city. We don't want you here at all.
But Dave, yeah, well, we're not going to say that, are we? And neither is David Lammy.
Well, they're not, but I think as time goes on, this is going to be on the agenda. Of course it is. I mean, how else are we going to stop what's been going on if we're not going to take some kind of action against the people concerned?
And yeah, I think so it's worth reflecting on that, you know, the direct political involvement of these people. So with Goldstein, his funding of Lammy's campaign to be the Labour candidate for Mayor of London. Obviously, you've got Lammy now as Foreign Secretary, you're denying a genocide has taken place in Gaza. And the guy running that campaign for Lammy is David Mentzer, who is now a spokesman for the Israeli government. You know, he's the guy who's often been on TV, on news channels, aggressively defending the actions of the IDF in Gaza.
Amazing. Anyway, so you've got this article out, Joe, just this week, which is linking this horrific development here in Bristol. I mean, I call it horrific. Obviously, the students want and need somewhere to stay, but they don't want to be in little rabbit hutches, tiny little places, which are about as small as you can be in before you go completely mad. So the title of the article is How Bristol's Tallest Building Will Be Linked to Israel's Atrocities. You say the relationship between Bristol's local state, its universities and global property investors is reshaping the city. The arrival of the city's tallest ever building exposes another dimension. And it does. You know, I think you've done a terrific job in digging out these connections. Now, we are told repeatedly that Hamas is the big danger. These people are dangerous. And if we're not allowed to just eliminate them all, which of course they haven't done, that Hamas is probably twice the size it was when the Israelis started their so-called mission to eliminate them, that they will take over the world and these people are very dangerous. But this seems to me to be part of the home, and I'll ask you both this, the home front, in a way. This is a money-raising property outfit that seems to be also politically lobbying for the Israeli state here in Bristol.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of what I'm covering in the article. You know, an aspect of it is questioning. I guess the question is how have we come to a situation where our political class, our government, are prepared to tacitly back the murder of tens of thousands of women and children. So that must lead us to ask ourselves where is Israeli power and influence, you know, and we need to be able to do that, without being smeared as an anti-Semite this is about the power and influence of a genocidal state, that's been taken over by madmen.
I wouldn't necessarily call them madmen. I think they're on a mission which is evil. I mean, everyone talked about Hitler as mad. I'm not so sure. I think he thought he was on some mission where he was doing maybe the right thing, but actually what it was totally destructive. Martin, so what do you make of this? Because, I mean, effectively, what planting this massive building right in the centre of Bristol, it's basically a money printing machine, isn't it? And it's printing money quicker than any other building in the city, by the looks of it.
Well, I mean, in a wider sense, property investment is a drain on the productive economy. If you can make more money by building buildings like this, why build
Rachel Reeves would say this is growth. This is fantastic.
Well, it is growth, but the question is, what kind of growth is it? You know, I mean, what you really need is small and medium enterprises, not people making money out of buildings.
Well, you don't make enough money out of small and medium enterprises.
That's the problem, isn't it? That's actually, why you don't have any small and medium enterprises.
Farmers,
all the money
fit into this too. You're not making enough money from farmers.
Well, indeed, but I mean, but the point is that the British economy has been run as this kind of property developer's paradise for years.
The skyscrapers do make a lot of money.
Economy. What's interesting to me about this is these people have obviously
Can you just come to that point, though? Because you're saying that it's not good for the economy. Reeves will say, yes, it is. It's actually fantastic for the economy to have more money being exchanged, you know, changing hands the whole time.
Look, the basic problem with the British economy going back decades is there's far too much money invested in real estate and property and hardly anything in what they call in Germany the Mittelstand, yeah? Small and medium enterprises, which employ people and are innovative and are creating new stuff. Buildings are just buildings at the end of the day. You know, they don't create that. You know, you build them, and then you're basically screaming off the profits from exploiting the fact that there is only a certain amount of land in Bristol, for example. You know, they're not making any more of it,
and exploiting that there's a housing crisis.
That's right.
But they come along saying, and the politicians say this, that they're the answer to the housing crisis because we're building.
Well, I mean, this is where Rachel Reeves has got it wrong. I mean, they're saying that they're going to allow lots of developers to build more houses, and that would make made, be absolutely useless to the people on the housing waiting list in Bristol.
How many people
they
in
will
the
never ever
in the
be
caravans?
Able to afford.
How many people in the caravans?
Exactly. So it's in other words, it's just I mean, basically, they're in the pocket of the developers. Don't forget that the Labour Party used to be funded by the trade unions, and the current Labour Party isn't funded by the trade unions. It's funded by people like this. And of course, they then want their pound of flesh, as it were, quite literally, from the politicians. What's interesting to me about this is that these guys are obviously quite right wing. They're friends with Netanyahu.
They're genocidalists.
Yes, but they're also interfering in Labour Party politics and pointing the people they want to see in the Labour Party. Now, you'd have thought, hang on a minute, why are extreme right wing Zionists having an influence in the Labour Party? And of course they are. They basically try and control all sides of the political spectrum. Yeah? But I mean, you know, you'd have thought the Labour Party would be asking, well, hang on a minute, why are we taking money from these extreme right wing property developers? But they are. And of course this is the way in which politics is corrupted. It's about money. Anybody who wants to be elected to anything needs resources. And of course it's always been an issue. The trade unions used to fund the Labour Party and therefore had some influence over it. But increasingly, of course, this new Labour regime we have is taking money from anybody. And of course those people have an agenda. And we can see this, in the US to an even greater extent. Nobody really has a chance in US politics who isn't prepared to go along with this super Zionist agenda. And it's becoming much the same in this country.
Well, I love the way you finished the article, Joe, which is looking at the completed building with its balconies, if they're still there when the building's completed. We're not sure if they really will build the balconies.
The rooftop terraces.
Looking down on exactly the same situation in the bear pit below, with tents still there and no housing crisis solved, but somebody making a fortune.
Yeah. It's part... these developments to me are part of there's a sort of broader phenomenon going on in the transformation of the city centre, it's this relationship between the university, the developers and investors, and the what I call the local state. So that's the city council and the West of England, the Mayor Authority, the West of England, combined authority, which you can see in something like the Temple Quarter regeneration project that's all based around this massive enterprise campus that the University of Bristol are building at the moment, £500 million project, has received 35 million from the West England Combined Authority. The City Council are spending around 10 million building a walkway along the harbour side to the campus. The former Mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees, immediately got an honorary professorship from the university when he left, having helped them out with these land deals. And you've got this sort of domination of the centre of a kind of transitory professional class, and everyone is pushed out to the margins.
Well, another thing is there's quite a lot of the luxury flats that have been built in the city centre, which I look up there some evenings and you see, well, maybe one or two lights on. A lot of them just seem to be buying them. Maybe only visit Bristol once or twice a year. They're almost like just as an investment.
Yeah. Well, you had that massively in London, don't you? Now you've got it in cities all over the world. Oh, sorry, all over Britain. But I would quickly recommend, there's a great book that's been written by... a guy called Isaac Rose, who we met actually, didn't we, when he came to Bristol last year. But he's written about Manchester, and it's this book called The Rentier City, Manchester and the Making of the Neoliberal Metropolis. And he really goes into great detail covering this phenomenon, with the idea that sort of Manchester has been the great example of it. But this is happening all over in places like Bristol.
Martin, what about solving this? Is it feasible? Can we do something else? I mean, those people in the caravans and the tents, is there anything for them? Any hope for them?
Well, the obvious thing to do, and that's actually recommended in, you know, Corbyn's manifesto, is to build council houses, which was what we always used to do. And, of course, we stopped doing that in the 1980s, sold off the existing stock to tenants at knockdown prices, which is a great freebie for them, but that's, you know, that's everybody's money that's being given away there. And the obvious thing to do is create low-cost, decent housing, and, you know, why not make the council housing? But, of course, we can't do that because that's crime think. You know, Rachel Reeves isn't going to do that. What are you on about? So there we are. And, of course, once Labour are kicked out, if they are kicked out, do you think Reform are going to build council houses? The Tories? Nobody's going to build council houses, but that's what we need. I mean, it's just obvious stuff, isn't it? And well, there is a solution, they just don't want to do it.
No. Anyway, look, so, Joe, what I'd like to do now is just to take a look at Gaza, actually, because, and the property development news this week that's come out from Donald Trump and Netanyahu, a press conference in the States, which I think most people were pretty shocked about. I mean...
Well, it's long been Jared Kushner's idea, I think, isn't it? Who has his own private equity property investment firm. You know,
well, look, I cannot fault you. Let's have a listen to Kushner speaking last year now.
There are real fears on the part of Arabs, and I'm sure you talk to a lot of them, who think once Gazans leave Gaza, Netanyahu's never going to let them back in.
Maybe, but I'm not sure there's much left of Gaza at this point. And Gaza's waterfront property, it could be very valuable to if people would focus on kind of building up you know, livelihoods. You think about all the money that's gone into this tunnel network and into all the munitions. If that would have gone into education or innovation, what could have been done? And so I think that it's a little bit of an unfortunate situation there. But I think from Israel's perspective, I would do my best to move the people out and then clean it up. But I don't think that Israel has stated that they don't want the people to move back there afterwards.
No, maybe they haven't stated it, and they're Dax, that's a bit embarrassing, isn't it, if you're just blowing this piece of land up. But anyway, that's last year. Martin, it's a bit cheeky, isn't it? They're doing this bit by bit, but it seems to me that the whole concept of disaster capitalism is there writ large. You know, Donald Trump is a New York property developer. He just sees Gaza as a nice bit of real estate, and he wanted the, you know, the guys in the caravans that used to live there out.
Well, I mean, it's another level, isn't it? It's provoked a lot of criticism from all sorts of quarters because it's just so blatant, isn't it? It's just unbelievable. But, of course, the problem they've got is that the Hamas fighters are still in the tunnels. And, of course, there's plenty of unexploded ordnance in the rubble. But, of course, they have been getting hold of that to make into their own weaponry. The IDF have been fighting for 15 months... but they haven't managed to get these the boys out of the tunnels. And if the US military went in there, or the British, because the British have been doing overflights of Gaza from Akrotiri, they will have the same problem as the IDF. They don't want to go into the tunnels because they will be killed in those tunnels. And I was looking at stuff recently where the IDF has started to admit that they've taken far more casualties than they previously admitted. So I can't remember where I was reading about this. But, you know, somebody has actually admitted that they've taken thousands and thousands of casualties. And if you think about it, it is a bit of a suicide mission to go into Gaza because, you know, you're fighting at very close quarters with people who just come up behind you when you can't see them and shoot you in the back of the head and then just disappear. So in actual fact, you can't win. And as long as they've got food down there in those tunnels, they're going to carry on fighting. And that'll be true whoever goes in there. So I don't think it's going to be developed in any kind of a way. The ceasefire is probably going to break down before it gets to the next phase, and they will carry on killing. So they'll have to kill them all. But, of course, by that stage, there might be some fight back from the rest of the community around, you know, in the terms of things like sanctions on Israel, or possibly just the Iranians hitting their army. The Iranians have got the missiles to wipe out thousands and thousands of Israeli soldiers.
And the Israelis,
that's what will happen.
The Israelis have got nuclear weapons, haven't they? They can
have.
Destroy Tehran just like that.
They could, but, of course, if they do fire a nuclear weapon at Tehran, the Iranians are now signed a treaty with the Russians, and the Russians have put them under their nuclear umbrella. So what could happen is that the Russians then nuke Israel, and they'd say to the Americans, do you want some of that? And the Americans go, well, no, we don't really.
So, anyway, Jared Kushner was saying this March last year, a year ago pretty much, sort of flagging it up that this is what their intentions were. Do you think Trump has just done what Kushner wants? Who is this Kushner guy? Why is
he
important?
He's married to Ivanka, isn't he? That's why. And of course, there's a load of gas, there's a gas field just off Gaza, which could, of course, be used by the Palestinians to build up a viable state and a community. But of course, it is their gas. But of course, they want to take it. And, it's just blatant looting, isn't it? And, criminality. And ultimately, this is World War III stuff, you know, this is the kind of thing, you know, Hitler invades Poland and the roof falls in. We're pretty much there, aren't we?
Yeah, with Kushner flagging this up this time last year, Joe, it does look as if this has been being planned for a while, doesn't it? And that it's almost like, slowly but surely, it's come out into the open that this genocide was really just a kind of... a land grab, really, just almost like a cover for a land grab. Let's just get rid of these people by whatever means.
Yeah, it's absolutely stomach churning to hear them talk in this way. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously this is probably this has been a topic of conversation over the Trump dinner table, you know, for quite a while.
Yeah, let's have a listen to Donald Trump then this week announcing his plans for Gaza, United States taking it over, apparently without actually using US troops. Maybe they'll farm that one out to the IDF.
I also strongly believe that the Gaza Strip, which has been a symbol of death and destruction for so many decades and so bad for the people anywhere near it, and especially those who live there, and frankly, who's been really very unlucky. It's been very unlucky. It's been an unlucky place for a long time. Being in its presence just has not been good, and it should not go through a process of rebuilding and occupation by the same people that have really stood there and fought for it and lived there and died there and lived a miserable existence there. Instead, we should go to other countries of interest with humanitarian hearts, and there are many of them that want to do this, and build various domains that will ultimately be occupied by the 1.8 million Palestinians living in Gaza, ending the death and destruction and, frankly, bad luck. This can be paid for by neighboring countries of great wealth. It could be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 12. It could be numerous sites, or it could be one large site. But the people will be able to live in comfort and peace, and we'll make sure something really spectacular is done. They're going to have peace. They're not going to be shot at and killed and destroyed like this civilization of wonderful people has had to endure. The only reason the Palestinians want to go back to Gaza is they have no alternative. It's right now a demolition site. This is just a demolition site. Virtually every building is down. They're living under fallen concrete that's very dangerous and very precarious. They instead can occupy all of a beautiful area with homes and safety, and they can live out their lives in peace and harmony instead of having to go back and do it again. The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site, level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out, create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs and housing for the people of the area. Do a real job, do something different. Just can't go back. If you go back, it's going to end up the same way it has for 100 years.
Martin, he's saying, first of all, how unlucky it is for them. Well, of course, I don't think there was a lot of luck involved, but also the world pretty much has condemned this roundly. Even the Starmer and the British government, who supported the genocide, are saying, no, this is not on.
Well, that's right. It's the thing about Trump is he says the quiet bit out loud, doesn't he? And that's why, of course, some people in the establishment don't like him, because he just comes straight out with it and says, well, we're just going to get rid of these people. And, of course, it's presented as some kind of humanitarianism. But, of course, it's a non-starter for the reasons I said earlier. The Hamas guys are still in the tunnels. Anybody who wants to redevelop Gaza has got to fight them out of the tunnels. And they haven't managed to do that in 15 months.
And he's saying the only reason that they're not going to live anywhere is because they haven't got anywhere to go. And now, actually, they have got somewhere to go. It's called Gaza.
Well, actually, there's large parts of Israel where they should go. Don't forget the people in Gaza used to look over the fence at their what used to be their villages and farms, which have been taken over. So most of the people in Gaza were driven there in 48. So they're not from there originally anyway. Same as in Jenin and places in the West Bank.
Well,
they're all refugees from what is now Israel. And, of course, ultimately, of course, we'd have to see Israel back to the agreed borders of 1948, which means no Jerusalem. You're not supposed to be in Jerusalem at all. That was not the original agreement. Jerusalem was explicitly excluded from the state of Israel.
But isn't this realpolitik agreements, a shm agreement? Look, we're there on the ground, and so you just have to deal with it. Joe, I just wonder if you've got anything to say about it. I mean, you might hear the BBC using a word like they use for the pager attacks, saying this is audacious, you know, even though actually these are horrific crimes which killed several children, maimed a lot of innocent people.
Did you see that Netanyahu gave a gold pager?
A gold pager as a present to Trump.
Grotesque. But
are you laughing there, Martin? It is grim, isn't it? That this is thought of as humour. Here is a gold pager for Trump. Yeah, I saw that.
But the thing with Trump is, I mean, it seems to me you can't trust anything that he ever says. And that's part of his armoury, is that no one can know. I mean, he does say the quiet part out loud, but why is he saying the quiet part out loud? I mean, you can't take anything at face value that he says. I think that he's always looking for lines of leverage, and he's playing off. I mean, he's got to deal with his big Zionist financial backers, hasn't he? I mean, he's taken a lot of money from people. But you know, on the other hand, I think you know he is a real estate developer, and that's how he sees the world. And yeah, so I think it's probably genuinely that is
1970s New York, now the world.
Yeah,
Let's just. And by the way, if I want to put something somewhere and something's in the way, I'm going to blow it to bits, and then I'm going to build it up.
Did you see that he's got his own cryptocurrency? So he started his own Trump cryptocurrency, and Melania's also started one of hers. And, of course, it's just a way of fleecing people. And it's like a Ponzi scheme. It's not got no intrinsic value. And, of course, the crypto billionaires aren't very happy because they want crypto to be, you know, part of the furniture. And then Trump's just trumped them by having his own version of it, which actually messes them up.
But there is something...
He's a very greedy person. You know, he just grabs everything that's in front of him.
That's how he's made his name. I mean, obviously, he's very seriously backed by, I think, isn't it, Sheldon Adelson in
he's dead
Las
now,
Vegas,
but his wife, Miriam.
And the you know that family have been backing him all the way. So you know, he's got his little oligarchs in the background who are pushing him. But this whole business
his dad used to be run loads of brothels, didn't he?
This whole business of pushing this stuff out in plain sight rather than planning it and plotting it and trying to make it look like it just happens, seems to me that's a way of that's an accelerationist policy. The idea is, well, we're not actually pretending anymore. We're just going to tell you all of the ridiculous things that we're planning, and it's all going to be out there, and that's going to make it happen faster because you won't be able to deal with the last atrocity before the next one comes along, and you'll be having to deal with that in your head, and we won't even pretend it's not happening. So it's a sort of psychological tactic to beat any opposition down, it seems to me. Also, alongside Donald Trump, in the States this week was, of course, Benjamin Netanyahu. He you know, presenting him with this golden pager, some sick joke about killing children and killing innocent civilians and killing people from Hezbollah, which, of course, is actually a clerical organisation. It's not a terrorist organisation in any real sense. It's a resistance organisation, quite legitimate politically, guaranteed by the the UN Charter and by the rights of self-defence of the Lebanese people, etc. But no, you know, this is okay to just kill anybody, even if they're a paramedic who's working with Hezbollah. And this sends a very strong sign out about the evil of the people like Netanyahu and Trump. But anyway, so there was an issue, I think, about the aircraft flying from Tel Aviv to the States, Martin. I don't know if you saw anything about that. Is that actually it hasn't quite got the range, so it may have had to touch down at some point between Tel Aviv with Netanyahu. And it was, I know Craig Murray pointed out that why none of the coverage included the fact that there is a warrant out for Netanyahu's arrest.
Well, yes. I mean, and obviously he's gone to the United States and they haven't arrested him. He didn't go to Auschwitz, Netanyahu, because the Poles have said that they wouldn't arrest him. But on the other hand, he didn't want to take the risk. I think, you know, there's some very interesting developments now in Belgium, where NGOs are basically chasing down Israeli soldiers who use social media to boast about various things they've done. And that's evidence. And so when they go on holiday, they got to think about being arrested.
It's funny because
in Brazil they were about to arrest them and the Mossad had to get them out
for years so and years.
You can do this, Martin, in the IDF and kill years, people, but you're never going to go on holiday again.
You've been talking about the rule of law. This is really important. You know, it's either there is a law, or maybe the law is just for us, not for them.
Well, that's clearly what's going on. You know, they want to, you know, the Trump administration has put sanctions on the International Criminal Court, but of course they still want the International Criminal Court to arrest Putin for stealing Ukrainian children, supposedly.
Well, yes, we were hearing last week, and if you missed that, folks, a very interesting interview about how we are stealing Ukrainian children.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously they couldn't really find anything to accuse Putin of, so they went for that. And of course, what he was really doing, when the latest round of fighting began, they just encouraged women and children to get out of there, get out of the way. And so they went to Russia. And they're basically safer in Russia than they are in the Donbass.
Almost everything that the Western elite, particularly Netanyahu and the likes, accuse the other side of, whether that's China or Russia, they're actually up to it themselves. And that's it's almost like they're trying to put this out as a way of diverting attention away from what they're up to. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Benjamin Netanyahu speaking with Trump at the press conference over in the States this week about this idea that the United States is now going to take over Gaza, clear out all the Palestinians and turn it into a resort for everyone. And this will be great because the poor old people of Gaza were very unlucky in the past.
You are the greatest friend Israel has ever had in the White House. And that's why the people of Israel have such enormous respect for you. In your first term, you recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. You moved the American embassy there. You recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. You withdrew from the disastrous Iran nuclear deal. I remember we spoke about it. You said, this is the worst deal I've ever seen. I'm elected. I'm walking out of it. That's exactly what you did. And I think it speaks loudly for just common sense, just looking at things and seeing them as they are. And, of course, you also brokered the groundbreaking Abraham Accords in which Israel made peace with four Arab states. We did this in 4 months. Nothing happened for a quarter of a century, but in 4 months, we were able, working together under your leadership, to have four historic peace accords. And now in the first days of your second term, you picked up right where you left off. Your leadership helped bring our hostages home, among them American citizens. You freed up munitions that have been withheld from Israel. They had been withheld from Israel in the midst of a seven-front war for our existence. And you just freed it. You ended unjust sanctions against law-abiding Israeli citizens. You boldly confronted the scourge of anti-Semitism. You stopped funding, as you just said, international organizations like UNRWA that support and fund terrorists. And today, you renewed the maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Ladies and gentlemen, all this in just 2 weeks. Can we imagine where we'll be in 4 years? I can. I know you can, Mr. President. For our part, we in Israel have been pretty busy too. Since the horrendous October 7th attack, we've been fighting our common enemies and changing the face of the Middle East. On that infamous day, Hamas monsters savagely murdered 1,200 innocent people, including more than 40 Americans. They beheaded men, they raped women, they burnt babies alive, and they took 251 people hostage to the dungeons of Gaza. And after this worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust, Iran and its henchmen in the Middle East were absolutely ecstatic. Hania praised the massacre. Sinwar said that Israel was finished. Nasrallah boasted that Israel was, here's what he said, as feeble as a spider's web. Well, Mr. President, Hania is gone. Sinwar is gone. Nasrallah is gone. We've devastated Hamas. We decimated Hezbollah. We destroyed Assad's remaining armaments. And we crippled Iran's air defenses. And in doing this, we've defeated some of America's worst enemies. We took out terrorists who were wanted for decades for shedding rivers of American blood, including the blood of 241 Marines murdered in Beirut. We accomplished all this with the indomitable spirit of our people and the boundless courage of our soldiers. The Bible says that the people of Israel shall rise like lions, and boy, did we rise. Today, the roar of the Lion of Judah is heard loudly throughout the Middle East. Israel has never been stronger, and the Iran terror axis has never been weaker.
So that's Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister and genocidalist, speaking in Washington earlier this week. I'm just concerned here that Joe, that he feels like he's on a roll, and he's saying here, well, this is what's happened in the first week of Trump's presidency. Think about what can happen in the next 4 years. There seems to be most definitely a plan to extend Israeli power. So what bothers me about this is all war crimes here. 40 or 50,000 minimum people killed, innocent people killed, including many, many children killed. And the idea here is that actually we're going to reward Netanyahu by actually expanding the whole program, the whole project, and the greater Israel is only just begun.
Yeah. You can see there are some of the things you list there are definite quote successes for Israel, but what's not in his assessment is how the world now sees Israel, and what the longer term impacts of that are going to be. In the eyes of most of the world, they have committed a genocide, and that can't be swept under the carpet and everything made good. You know, there's going to be this sort of grinding, degrading of attitudes towards Israel. And how it tries to maintain its power and its influence.
Yeah, when you can't maintain your power and influence if no one wants to be involved. I mean, I think maybe over the years, Martin, we've seen all sorts of empires, you know, the age of empires, some of them brutal, some of them less brutal. One of the most brutal ones recently, of course, has been the US empire after the Second World War. It seems to me that the next generation of the big global empires, if this is allowed to continue, is going to be one of the most horrific genocidalists ever.
Yes, I mean, it hardly bears thinking about where we could be in 4 years' time. Perhaps we won't even be here in 4 years' time. That's how bad it is. Incidentally, of course, Trump himself saying there are 1.5 million people in Gaza. That's actually an admission, because there's probably, the latest estimates are about 2.5 million people in Gaza. So he's actually saying that in actual fact, the death toll is far higher than the official death toll. And of course, the official death toll, the Hamas-run health ministry, is really only counting people who've actually been identified. So, you know, it's quite likely that they've killed possibly 500,000 people in the last 12 months.
I think it's in the Lancet that is talking about they're reckoning the estimates from just literally interviews with nurses and doctors that have been out there, around about 150,000 dead.
Yeah, and I think that's an underestimate. I mean, it's hard to say, but I think it is an underestimate. Don't forget, people have been starved. They've had no medical attention. People are dying from, preventable diseases. It's not just people having their heads blown off. Well, it's horrendous. But, of course, Israel is a tiny little speck of a state, really. And if they go to war with Iran, which they seem to want to do, they are going to be pulverized. The Iranians, Iran's big. It's a big place. You're not going to be able to kill everybody in Iran, but the Iranians could absolutely, if they concentrate their fire on the Israeli defence forces, they could probably kill tens of thousands.
I don't want to put in ideas into Netanyahu. I'm sure I don't need to be doing that, but you know, with 200 nuclear weapons, you could pretty much destroy Iran, couldn't you?
Well, they can. Sheldon Adelson, who was a big friend of Trump's, was saying, well, we should just turn it into a car park. You know, that's what we need to do. But, of course, if they do that, then it will be World War III, and there won't be any Israel left at the end of it. There probably won't be any Britain left at the end of it.
OK, well, look, before we say goodbye to Joe, Martin, can you just say what you make of this whole idea of the home front? Because there seems to be quite a lot going on here in terms of political lobbying, controlling the Metropolitan Police, arresting journalists, and now, of course, massive property developments in Israeli interests. This is the home front of what's going on out in the Middle East, isn't it?
It is, and it means that we've got things we can do here to draw attention to that. You know, we've actually got, issues here in Bristol where we can say, hang on a minute, what's happening here? So it's not just watching it on the telly or looking at it on your phone. It's actually in your face if you're going shopping in the centre of Bristol.
Any last thoughts about, the rights and wrongs of this particular development and how things might change, Joe, for the better?
Ooh, for the better. as Martin says, this development is going to be the most prominent building in the city, in its 1,000-year history. To me, it's highly significant that what these structures are. Are vessels for Israeli capital and the people who are involved, are kind of at the front line here in Britain, on propping up the genocidal government in Israel. I would just, if listeners are interested, please go to my Substack and you can read the article there.
So it's Joe Banks, one word, .substack.com.
Yeah.
The article is called, if I can just scroll to the right point on it, How Bristol's Tallest Building Will Be Linked to Israel's Atrocities. But look, I'm not going to let you get away that easily. How can we? Is there any possible way to fix these the planning system in the city? Because it seems that there is. It's almost as if the rule book has been torn up by people like Rachel Reeves, by the previous mayor Marvin Rees, and now developers. I mean, the whole planning process now seems to be just a rubber stamp for whatever the developers and the speculators want.
Yeah, no, I'm afraid I'm very pessimistic about it. I think it's getting worse, and the planning department. The planning committees. Are called development control committees, but there's very little of that going on. You know, really, they see the bureaucratic managers there really see their role to not get in the way of what these developers and investors want, and what institution, you know, powerful institutions like the university want, and you know, things like, you know, urbanism, design, what actually creates a good environment to live in. You know, all that goes by the wayside, and that's only been reinforced by the current Labour government's growth strategy, which is, again, chuck all that stuff and environmental stuff out the window, and it's just all about growth figures.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've already spoken to the former mayor of Bristol, and also who is the president of Royal Institute of British Architects, that's George Ferguson, about this, and he's promised he'll come in a few weeks' time. So it'd be nice if you could join us as well, Joe, to actually explore some of the positive campaigning to stop this kind of thing happening and identifying ways to control development so that we don't end up with some kind of megalopolis, incredibly ugly,
yeah,
and awful places to live. Well,
and George Ferguson, yeah, thank you, I'd love to do that. And George Ferguson was one of the people who led what's called the fight for Bristol in the 1970s, when you had this coming together of amenity groups and architects who did stage quite a, you know, impressive fight back against the forces at work then, you know, to really trash the city.
Yeah, I mean, there was even one of the most surprising things from the 70s I heard about was that they wanted to fill the docks in, the floating harbour. They just wanted to fill it all in and build all over
plans,
it. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the Bristol we've got today if it wasn't for them. So, yeah, let's do that in future weeks. Joe Banks, .substack.com. Joe Banks, the human being too. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Cheers.
And we're going to hear now from a chappie. His name is Stephen Kappos, and on the similar subject with Israel and Gaza, really, he's a Holocaust survivor that's been turning up at some of these demonstrations in central London for Palestine and against the Israeli genocide.
I say this as a Holocaust survivor, that the genocide in Gaza is not happening in my name and in our name. The way that the Israeli government is using the memory of the Holocaust in order to justify what they are doing to the Gazans is a complete insult to the memory of the Holocaust. It's an outrage. When I saw the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations putting on a yellow star, it was stomach-turning. Somebody who had to wear a yellow star, like myself and my entire family, I'm insulted by that. What distinguishes the Jewish Holocaust is its industrial scale and industrial methods being applied. And what has been happening to Gaza is similar in that the scale of the bombing and the indiscriminate nature of the bombing, the complete lack of care about children and women being the majority of the victims, amounts to industrial scale of genocide. The painting of the Palestinian people as worthless, almost animal-like by the description of some of the leaders. That dehumanization enables the population of Israel to tolerate what's going on. The way that Palestinian people who were arrested were treated, having to take their clothes off and parading them, it's part of the humiliation. In the West Bank, the way the checkpoints are organized, the way that you are forced to wait for hours for no reason in order to go to school or go to work, etc. All this amounted to humiliation, similar to what we experienced. The sort of determination and consistency with which they are setting about to destroy the whole of Gaza is very similar to the kind of cruelty and determination of the fascist regimes, some of the actions of the Nazi state in dehumanizing and completely cruel large-scale killings, etc. If it is repeated, I don't see why you couldn't make the parallel. It can only be helpful in understanding what's going on to make the parallel. I don't think there should be any taboo against that. I think I particularly find painful to see the children, because I remember after the war, you know, we played in the ruins like they do now, but particularly at their losses, to suddenly lose parents and siblings and so on, you know. There was a boy in the same rescue homes where I was. He was traveling on a tram with his parents. This boy moved to the front to stand behind the tram driver because he was interested in how he was working the levers and so on. At the next stop, an Arrow Cross raiding party came on and asked for papers. And the parents were identified as Jews and arrested straight away. The son was separated at the front. And they had to make an immediate decision whether to say something to him and involve him or let him perhaps escape the net. And that's what they decided. So they were taken down from the tram and sent to Auschwitz. They never said goodbye to their son, and they perished in Auschwitz. So that was the end of the family. Now, can you imagine the psychological state of that boy who suddenly found himself on his own in this way, not saying goodbye to his parents? And I think this kind of thing, this separation, And the sense of complete inability to intervene or in any way exert any kind of positive influence on events, this kind of separation and destruction of families in this manner is again something that repeats in Gaza now, I think.
So that's Stephen Kapos, a Holocaust survivor, speaking, who's been speaking at these rallies in central London, really about the comparison between what's been going on in Gaza, in the West Bank, Palestine generally, to the Nazis. And I'm joined now here in the studio by Matt O'Brannan. Hi, Matt, again.
Kia ora, guys.
Okay, what does that mean?
That means it's a Maori phrase we use in New Zealand a lot, where I spent most of my life.
It's like some sort of orange drink.
Yes, that's right. It had a beautiful theme song. I remember that from my youth in England as well, because I was born here. The Kia ora. And what it means generally, I believe, is be well. Which I think is just a really great affirmation to...
Well, with you turning up on the scene and a nice cup of coffee, how could we be anything but well?
Hey,
and so you've been going to some of these demonstrations, I know,
yeah.
And we spoke to Piers Corbyn the other day, who'd been arrested for apparently trying to go to the BBC. Now, this is a big thing over Christmas.
Yep.
Owen Jones did a report on the BBC and said something about the... specific individuals. I think it's Deborah Furness, who's the head of news, as well as Raffi Berg,
yes,
who's ex CIA front organization, who's now online editor for the BBC covering Gaza and the Middle East. So obviously there is a horrific bias going on from the intelligence services in the West trying to steer the news. So the point was that the Stop the War Coalition, Palestine Solidarity and the rest decided they wanted to go march to the BBC.
Well, yeah, and in fact, this is the only London march. I've been on many Bristol ones. This is the only London march I went to specifically because they were going to the BBC. And, you know, anyone who knows me campaigning about Assange, I have come to see just how crucial the media is. Information is to our rights. It doesn't get more fundamental. If you don't know about abuses, you cannot solve them. So I was very inspired to join this particular march because they were going to the BBC, and as you say, Owen Jones and others, I mean, anyone can see it with their own eyes now, which is in some ways a silver lining of this horrible cloud, is that now the general populace is much more becoming aware of the how unreliable our media is at reporting the important truths.
Well, it's what's so funny is that they actually spend a lot of their time these days going on about social media and how terrible it is. Well, I mean, you know, you feel like saying every time, you feel like saying, well, if you weren't so rubbish, maybe everyone wouldn't be on social media, mate.
That's right. The disinformation experts telling us, I mean, that word disinformation now is a real red flag to me. Anyone that's trying to stamp out disinformation, generally the ones that are best at it. So, yes, I went to the march, and then a whole nother element unfolded, because the week of the march, or just the few days before, we started to hear that, hey, actually, we may not be allowed by the police to go to the BBC. It's just, hang on, what? You know? And so the way I describe it is that if we are aware that our government is involved in supporting a genocide, whether it's supplying weapons or political cover, I should see Keir Starmer's comments about starving the whole population, saying that's fine. And then we also see and have evidence of the BBC being biased. And as you say, Ruffy Berg, he was shown to have posted on Twitter that Netanyahu had a copy of his book on his shelf. And he was gloating, you know, seemed extremely happy about that, posing for pictures with members of Mossad and smiling.
I thought that we weren't supposed to know who Mossad were. Aren't they supposed to be, you know, spies? Or we're not supposed to know who they are, surely.
So, you know, now we have hard evidence of what we can see with our own eyes.
Rafi knows. Maybe, in fact, he is one.
Yeah,
I mean, the way these things, the intelligence services work, is through agents of influence. I mean, they have intelligence officers who are military officers, effectively, and they run agents, and those are agents of influence. Now, one of the places they obviously want to influence is the mass media. I mean, if they can get somebody telling millions of people something that they want to hear and ignoring something they don't want people to hear, that's an agent of influence.
Of course. I mean, you'd be so foolish if you were an empire with any sort of naughty goals. You'd be a fool not to try and corrupt the media as much as you possibly could. So we can't be naive to it. And we will get on to, I hope, talking about USAID in a minute too, but for now we'll stay with this.
What happened to you? So where were you? In Trafalgar Square, is it? And BBC's a little walk from there, up Regent Street. I used to cycle up there to work, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And then you go across Oxford Circus, and then you've got Broadcasting House with that strange carving in Broadcasting House. I can remember chatting to Gemma Cooper from the BBC here in Bristol about that. Actually, the carving was done by a guy who turned out to be a paedophile. And so there was a whole sort of thing about that as well. Maybe it's still there, apparently. Still there, sitting there.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's sorry to distract you with little tale about Broadcasting House. But were you allowed to go anywhere near there? If not, why not?
No, yes. If not, why not? That's a great question. And what does it mean for our democracy? Because, you know, if we are, as I say, aware that our government is complicit in a genocide, potentially, so the ultimate crime that you can possibly imagine, and the BBC is exposed for bias and support and service of it as well. The last democratic peaceful right we have left as citizens is to demonstrate peacefully, and they took that away. You know, this is, to me, a huge red line. I don't know how to describe that whole interlinking of those elements as total fascism and just the greatest criminality and sort of authoritarian you know, conspiracy that there is. It's just, it doesn't get any worse than that.
Well, no, and Piers was saying that he had a bunch of flowers he wanted to, with a little note about saying, you know, please report properly on the genocide.
Yeah.
He wanted to take that to the BBC, and he was arrested for that. And this is peaceful.
Exactly.
Of course, the idea here, Martin, is that if people are not allowed to peacefully demonstrate, then they might find some other rather more violent way to do it.
Well, I mean, that's obviously a potential. We saw that happen in 1969 in Belfast and Derry, didn't we? And, of course, that's part of our country. The police were well out of order here because they shouldn't, you know, there is absolutely no case to be made that we can't protest outside the BBC. We pay for the BBC. It's supposed to be neutral. And if it's not, we should be able to call them to account. And the Metropolitan Police have been got at by the Zionist lobby. And, of course, the guy in charge of it on the day was saying it was criminality by the people who were organising this protest because they didn't do what we told them to do. But that's because the police are out of order. They should allow peaceful demonstrators to demonstrate. And there hasn't been any major trouble on any of these demonstrations.
Yeah.
Unlike Bloody Sunday, for example, where the lads were in fact throwing rocks at the police and the army before they were all shot dead. The Derry Young Hooligans, as they used to call them. There's nobody throwing rocks at the police here? Nothing like that. And they just jumped on you, didn't they? What have you been charged with?
Well, no, just hang on, Martin. Mm. We're jumping ahead here. I just want to know what happened.
Yeah, I mean, all those points are absolutely correct that you said, because so the police had, and the organisers of the protest had confirmed back in November where they would go. So the original plan was we would meet at the BBC and then march towards Whitehall for the speeches. And then, so that was, and then the week of the protest or march, the police suddenly came back at the last minute and said, no, we've talked to a local group. There's a synagogue near the BBC, apparently two blocks away. So you cannot meet at the BBC. So, as you say, they've had over 20 of these marches and there has not a single incident of harm to people or property whatsoever so far. Same group of organizers. So there is no evidence of any harm. There are Jewish members on the march. The gentleman that you just played, he spoke at the march, and in fact spoke about fascism. He said, comparing this to what's happening to the fascism of Nazi Germany should not be taboo any longer. It's nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It's to do with anti-genocide, isn't it? So
where were you and what happened to you?
Yeah, so, I mean, I was arrested along with, I believe, about 77 other people.
So how far up Regent Street did you get towards the BBC?
Oh, I mean, I don't know, to be honest, because I'm not as familiar with the London and the BBC as you are.
Okay, very simple. It's Trafalgar Square.
Anyway.
Trafalgar Square, and then you've got a little bit around a corner and sort upwards, and then you've got Oxford Circus, then you've got the BBC. It's probably about
very close to
maybe
Trafalgar.
Between 5 and 10 minute walk.
Yeah, we were like 100, we got stopped about 100 metres off Trafalgar Square.
Right, so you got absolutely nowhere near.
Absolutely nowhere.
So you could have been going to Hamley's to buy some toys in the shop on Regent Street. nothing to do with going to the BBC, really. You were nowhere near it.
Yeah. So apparently, I didn't know this personally, but apparently the conditions of the march were at the last minute, you know, as I said that we were supposed to stay at Whitehall. Now, I want to point out as well that the organisers of the march also put together a very reasonable compromise. They looked at when the synagogue closed, and it closed at 1:30, and they said, look, if we just turn the march around and we meet at Whitehall and have the speeches and then go to the BBC, we'll arrive well after 1:30. So even though there's no risk and it's two blocks away, it'll also be closed. So what on earth do the police think that they are doing? There's not just nothing at all to suggest that there was any risk to anybody or any property. So it is preposterous, as you guys have said. So, and we got 100 metres from Trafalgar Square and they stopped us. Another important point is that police put out a statement on Twitter and social media saying that we broke through a police line. And there is hard video evidence that is not what happened at all. We were allowed through by the police, and there was no force at all. As you say, there was Jeremy Corbyn and others holding flowers and, you know, just sort of standing there. And they announced on the loudspeaker to us all, look, we're going to attempt to walk to the BBC. If we are stopped, we will stop. You know, we're going to march peacefully with these flowers. And they say, we expect to be stopped. When that happens, we're going to lay the flowers down at the feet of the police. But in fact, what happened, the police didn't stop us originally. They allowed us through. And that is what they claim a whole lot of us have broken the law over. Not staying. So I've been charged with not remaining at Whitehall, when in fact we were just allowed through. And once we were stopped 100 metres from Trafalgar Square, they did a line and they stopped us. We just stopped. Nobody tried to break through. There was no force. We were upset. It was disturbing to be prevented from peacefully protesting at our public broadcaster, which should be the last right we should have to peacefully, you know, and you raise the issue, look, what's next? If we can't demonstrate peacefully, what are our options after that? And I'd never advocate for violence, but, you know, what is next? What is after that? So, and what happened to me is the march at some point sort of like everyone sort of started disappearing. I wandered back to Trafalgar Square and I ran into some Assange people from the Assange campaigners, the grassroots, and it was lovely to see them. And not surprising, In fact, I want to point out that all of the MPs involved in this demonstration that spoke, all were the same MPs who spoke up for Julian Assange, from Jeremy Corbyn to John, gosh, I'm not going to get the names right.
John McDonnell.
And there was a lady, she's lovely, I can't remember her name. There's a number of them, all of them, all the same MPs that spoke up for Assange.
Zara Sultana.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, maybe we should just get rid of all the other MPs and have an alternative parliament, just the ones with a bit of integrity.
It's such a great litmus test, I tell you. If check anyone's history, if they spoke up for Assange or not, whether it's a journalist or a politician, that's the litmus test for me.
It is. No, you're right. I agree.
Yeah, it's a great... It's
so
handy.
What happened? Anyway, what happened? Did you get cuffs or what happened?
Yeah. So a policeman approached me. Most of the people had already moved on, but there was a huge police presence still. They were blocking off three streets connected to Trafalgar Square. And I was just filming it and documenting it because I went there with the intention to do a video piece on the whole thing about the BBC and the march. So it ended up also being about the police. And so I was giving them a bit of cheek, but not in a rude way.
Oh, that's fatal, mate.
Yeah.
The Metropolitan Police don't have a sense of humor.
But, you know, I've got a way of doing it. My philosophy is not to be, not to be abusive. No. But I will have a light-hearted poke and about truth, and I would say, look, these guys are just doing their job, aren't you? I was speaking to one of them. You're just doing your job, aren't you? Preventing us from peacefully demonstrating at our public broadcaster because bias support of a genocide, the ultimate crime. You're just doing your job, right?
Yeah, okay.
And they're sort of nodding and then looking a bit worried. That sort of thing. But at this point, that was actually a bit prior. At this point, I really wasn't saying anything. I was just filming them, and then one of them approached me and said, look, we're asking people to move along. And I said, okay, sure. And I just asked him, but tell me what you think about the fact that we weren't allowed to march today to the BBC. And then he said, oh, look, we can walk and talk. So I was like, okay, all right. And I agreed. I did think it was unusual that I wasn't allowed to stand on the pavement. I was like, does he actually have any legal? But he was saying, we're going to take you in if you don't comply. So I was like, okay, well, it seems bizarre. I can't believe that he has the power to stop me from just standing on the footpath. There's nothing, there's no threat. There's hundreds of police and there's about, I don't know, 50 people from the march left and hundreds of police. So I was like, okay, but I'm just going to do what he says. And I actually do. I start walking away, and I've got video of myself doing this because I was filming it. So I don't know what they're trying on here at all. It seems very bizarre, but I'm literally complying with that request, even though I thought it was strange. And next thing I hear some shouting. There's a supervisor officer pointing at me, and a whole group just come over and grab me straight away. And they say, you didn't do what we told you. And I was like, I literally did, and I've got video evidence of it, and they just put me straight into cuffs, and I'm just going, what are you doing? I was doing what you asked me. And there you go, and that's what they claim. They claim that they told me to move, and I didn't, and it's an absolute lie.
Well, we really shouldn't be talking about this since you've been charged.
Right.
But you know what? Yeah. Let's talk about it anyway, because it annoys me that often they charge people in order to just shut them up. So you're not supposed to talk about it. So we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. And the other thing is, one of the reasons they may well have picked on you, Matt, I think, is because you had a camera. That's one of the other things that they, because they don't know who is streaming live or selling footage to news, that sort of thing. They don't know where about. So they quite like to have footage. And so they can quite easily nab you for that. I would say, from the police's point of view, though, you probably should have just done what the guy said straight away rather than decided you wanted to have a chit chat with him first. No,
that's right. Well, I think, just to be honest, I only really registered what he said when I watched the video back of it, because he said it in such a casual way. He said, we're asking people to move along. It wasn't, he didn't say, get out of here now. And at first, you know, and when he did make that clear, I did, you know, so he said, we're asking people. I was like, okay, but why can't I, you know, I was still in the mindset of like, well, why can't we do what we set out to do? So, you know, once he made it clearer, he was like, no, I want you to move or we're taking you in. I was like, okay, that's fine. Don't have to ask twice.
And you were inside for what? They let you out, what, 3 a.m. they normally do, don't they? Something like that.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in 12 hours.
Where were you? Which custody suite?
Yes. What was it? It was delightful accommodations. It gave me a real, Hammersmith, I think.
Okay, Hammersmith.
And so 12 hours, and as you say, they turf you out. They don't tell you when they're going to turf you out.
No, they just do it.
They told me I could contact, they would contact someone for me. It's like impossible to arrange. I don't live in London. And I told them that. I was like, I'm missing my bus and I don't, you know, so they're aware of this. It's a very cold night. And I give them a name. I say, can I have two names? Cause I'm supposed to meet someone tonight.
To get a phone call, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't apparently allowed a phone call. They said they'll contact them for me. So that was interesting. That was a bit of a shock to me. I was like, okay.
See, some of this may be to do with terrorism legislation, just because you're supposed to be a terrorist, etc. So anyway, what stage is all this at now? Are you supposed to go to London to appear in court over this fiasco?
Yeah, I've got to appear and we'll see whether or not the police have got to convince the courts to take this on, and you know, which would probably be quite ill-advised, but depends what their goal is.
Are you up for that? Are you looking forward to a potential court case? Or
what? Oh, I mean, look, I respect the law. You know, that's why I fought for Julian Assange, because he exposed crimes. I want a good society where our government and our police abide by the law as well.
So you're a sort of policeman out of uniform?
No, I'm a citizen journalist. That's me. I like to shed a light on things, and I will peacefully go up to that line and call it for what it is, and if I suffer consequences for that, then let the world see that.
The genocide has kind of stopped. Stopped with Trump for a while. Mm. We'll see, but it's still coming up week after week after week. Thank God, in the House of Commons at Prime Minister's Questions. This is this Wednesday, and I think the speaker is Richard Tice from the Reform Party, asking a question of Prime Minister Keir Starmer about Gaza.
Richard Tice,
thank you, Mr. Speaker. After she was kidnapped and shot, Emily Damari was held in captivity by Hamas in UNRWA facilities, confirming many of our fears that UNRWA is riddled with Hamas sympathisers. So, the British people do not want our aid being stolen by Hamas. So will the Prime Minister agree with me that we should stop funding Hamas, follow the example of other nations, and divert our aid to other, more trustworthy agencies?
Prime Minister.
On the question of Emily Damari, I've spoken with Mandy on many occasions, including when she didn't know whether her daughter was alive or not. And just listening to her was to really understand the torture that she went through. I spoke just the other day to Emily herself about the conditions in which she was held, and of course I will continue to do so. But to be absolutely clear, and he knows this, we're not funding Hamas, never will we condemn Hamas, and everybody in this house should condemn Hamas.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? It's almost like the Parliament, apart from the people you were talking about, seem to be trying to out-compete each other to support the genocide.
That's right. I don't hear the condemnation of Israel in there. Seems somewhat missing. I've got no problem if anybody was going. I think it's appropriate, to be honest, in most respects, to condemn any violence, in all respects, to condemn any violence by anybody. If it's one-sided, you know, I called out Hamas's attack on October 7th immediately. Any violence to me is just straight wrong. But of course, there is a very complex picture. You do have to come back to that question again, or also put things in perspective. What are Hamas? What are they supposed to do when they are, you know, in a open air prison, according to the UN Secretary General? And they are having water cut off, and they're desperate people, and this is to be expected, and we know that in fact it's planned. Netanyahu, there is a Wikipedia page, I saw it today, about how Israel has supported Hamas the whole time. WikiLeaks published the evidence that Netanyahu had said at a Likud party, I don't know how to pronounce that, L-I-K-U-D.
Likud, yeah.
Likud party meeting, that if we are to prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, we must support Hamas. And there is evidence that they have been providing money the entire time. And also,
I think it's been coming via Qatar. Martin, do you want to say something about this? Because it's not really spoken much about by Rafi Berg at the BBC, is it?
Strangely missing from the discussion.
Netanyahu is saying things like, in order to prevent a Palestinian state, we must fund Hamas.
Well, I mean, the Hamas were encouraged by the Israelis as a means of undermining the PLO and Fatah, who are the secular nationalists. Faction, and so
he's not trying to start a religious war by any chance, is he?
Well, no, the point is that Hamas perfectly legitimately, in my view, refused to accept the existence of the State of Israel. The Fatah and the PLO had agreed that they would recognise Israel, provided that they would be recognised in return. Hamas said, well, we're not recognising you because, you know, you haven't recognised us, so why should we recognise you? That's the sort of thing that could be negotiated, but you can't just presume that they've got to say we were in favour of it at the beginning. And, of course, there was an election in 2006, both in Gaza and the West Bank, and Hamas won it. So Richard Tice is become an MP in this country at the last election, but Hamas are the elected government of Palestine. And of course, the violence on October the 7th, some of which was, don't forget, they took prisoner quite a lot of military personnel. And of course, everybody of military age in Israel, apart from the religious Jews, serves in the reserve. So they're all legitimate targets. They're not hostages. Yeah, so they're prisoners of war.
National service.
They're prisoners of war. Yeah, that's what they are. And, of course, the most people killed on the day were killed by the Hannibal Directive, by the Israeli armed forces, who were prepared to kill their own people rather than see them taken prisoner.
Yeah, you're nodding away to this conspiracy theory, Matt.
It's not a conspiracy theory, it's just a fact. What happened.
The Israeli general, what's his name? I saw I don't know the source, but I saw today that he has said not only was the Hamas, the Hannibal Directive used, he said it hadn't been used enough.
But somebody like Jonathan Pollard, who was a spy in the US, who got released, as you know, he was saying, well, the relatives of the hostages just shut up. We shouldn't even think about them. We should just get on with killing the Palestinians.
And the Israeli,
and that is the attitude.
Papers, Haaretz has also made these put these facts out there as well, that the Hannibal Directive was used. There's Israeli offence forces that have said the same.
Well, some of these Israeli young women that have just been released were in fact Israeli soldiers, and they were involved in monitoring what was going on in Gaza, and they were sending messages to their superiors in Jerusalem saying, well, look, you know, we think there's something going on here, we think they're plotting something.
Wow.
And of course, that there's a big question inside Israel itself, well, why didn't somebody notice what was going on? And it's because it was basically allowed to happen. So that loads of military had been sent away to the West Bank for the holidays. And of course, that's why Hamas thought that they would have a tough time coming out when they came through the fence. But they found in actual fact, everything was there for them to seize.
Lie hop. Let it happen on purpose. Anyway, look, you mentioned USA. Did you want to say something else
there? Yeah, just to finish that. That does make you wonder whether that's another reason why we've seen Netanyahu very not keen to get these hostages home. Is it because they were involved in gathering that intelligence?
Yes, well, I mean, these women, of course, and in actual fact, if you saw them when they were handed over, they were looking pretty good. You know, they were waving and smiling.
Better than a Palestinian prisoner.
Was the Palestinian prisoners coming out of prisons? Well, they are actually, they've been tortured systematically. I mean, people have been killed by having stuff so rammed up their backsides in Israeli prisons.
And so to come back to what Keir Starmer is saying there, he's suggesting that we should stop funding to UNRWA because allegedly Hamas has made use of some facility that was allegedly. Well, if that logic holds, then and we know that Netanyahu in Israel has been funding Hamas from the start, What does that mean? Should we cut off funding to Israel then as well, if we're going to be consistent here, Keir Starmer?
Well, there's a message for Donald Trump as well, I think. Before we get, and we're going to finally chat to you about USAID that's been defunded by Trump, Matt. But before that, we've got a poem about what she calls, this is Patrizia this week. It's called The Riviera of Blood. Who's fooling who? The Oval Office, no circle. Now ever be squared. A ventriloquist dummy in hoc, au contraire. Beware of gold pager, a veiled threat now on show. Do as you're told, or perhaps face off may blow. Advisors in waiting, vile teal and the rest, pushing agendas for Zion, invest. BB a hoodlum, evil smile saw on stage, a Riviera of blood, the world now outraged. Abraham discord, the clean break all began, the Middle East begone, greater Israel the plan. The Don threw the Saudis under the bus, the UAE unmasked, now gone is the trust. Who's fooling who? Double deals twist the knife. Confusion, illusions with Iran now want strife. Chump speaks as he thinks, no hiding intentions, a president unhinged without interventions. Gaza, we're with you. God will always raise fools to drop from on high into snake pools. Time is a passing, and now long overdue to defend those in Gaza, Palestine. 'Tis true. The best plan of all, move illegal settlers out and give the land back to the Palestinians, no doubt. Massacre, mass murders on the Riviera of death, billionaire stakeholders in genocide invest. A den of iniquity now surrounds the lost Don, a man with an ego, anyhow, hope, now long gone. What do you make, Matt, of this idea of the Riviera of death? I mean, this is what it seems to me, what is wanted for Gaza is to create this, you know, kind of obscene, decadent beach resort on top of the genocide underneath it.
Yeah, horrific. I suppose, though, many, many places through history have been created that way, but we like to think we can put that behind us and no longer, moving into the information age, we should be able to. But I think the empire hasn't caught on yet that we can see it. It's being live streamed. It's not going to look good. They're undermining their own integrity. It's disgusting, as you put it.
I suppose they think they'll be able to control the way this is spun in the future.
Yeah,
anyway, USAID is a bit like the Brits have got something called the British Council, which is on a much smaller scale. But I think it's called white propaganda. I'm not absolutely sure the term for it. But the idea is this is in plain sight, and it's US funding all around the world for various civil society groups in different countries to try to turn that country toward the United States. So they will be trying to intervene politically, they will be demonstrating on the streets in some places, but that's USAID. What do you make about of Trump saying he's just going to cut the funding for it?
I think it's incredible, and I think the chaos of what has emerged in the last few days since he's actually shut them out of their office and paused the funding has been incredible. We've seen Reporters Without Borders, whose work on Assange I greatly respected and appreciated. I first noticed they were crying when Zuckerberg announced he was going to stop censorship on Facebook, his fact-checking, and they complained. I was like, that's odd. And now it appears that they are indeed funded partly by USAID themselves, and now it makes a lot more sense because that certainly seems to serve their interests. It's incredible, and for me it's a moment of like, now things make sense, because I wasn't actually someone who followed the news much until I began campaigning for Assange about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. And since then, we became very invested in following things and also very interested in how the media operated, or didn't work, as it should. And I was always aware, because I saw what happened with Iraq, so I was aware the media was flawed, But I still didn't have any idea how bad it actually is. I think most people don't have an idea of quite just how bad. It is profound, and I've just seen it consistently over and over different issues. The ones that really matter, they get completely wrong. They subterfuge the truth in, you know, to serve the empire. And it's so bad. It's shocking. And now it seems to all make sense. When you see the list of organizations that USAID funds, to further US interests, that's their mandate. And we go down, and I'm looking at a list here, Politico, Associated Press, the New York Times, Reuters, the BBC, the Guardian, they took, I believe, $3 million in the last year. Oh, sorry, that was the BBC took $3 million, the Guardian $1 million, Sunday Times, and it goes on and on and on and on and on and on. And it's now, it's around the world, and it just makes so much sense now how we have a global media that constantly ignores the egregious crimes of the US empire. And there are many going on at the moment. All of them could be described as the greatest crimes of the century by far.
So do you think there's not much point in you putting in an application for this show then anymore, since they're being closed down?
For what?
A million might be coming in handy, Martin, mightn't it?
You could get some kebabs and that would be, you know.
Anyway, so, I mean, you're right about Reporters Without Borders. This is, I mean, Martin, for a long time, Index on Censorship, people didn't realise that this was actually largely CIA-funded. The idea is that they're trying to control both sides of the chessboard.
Yeah, USAID was originally founded by John F. Kennedy, so it was his brainchild, and the idea of it was that, you know, we're not just going to send troops out into the third world, we're going to send, you know, the Peace Corps, USAID, we're going to be helping people. And I worked with a guy from USAID when I was in Bosnia, it was a guy called Karel, who was a Czech guy. And of course, they were doing aid work like we were. We were providing food for people in refugee camps. So, you know, USAID has got that kind of background as well. But of course, they're also doing what you might call civil society stuff, a bit like the National Endowment for Democracy. They are basically doing the sort of things that the CIA used to do under the table. You know, they're basically trying to influence people all over the world. And of course, Trump, you know, sees it as a great big boondoggle, so he's got rid of... Of course, the Israelis and the Egyptians have not had any of their funding cuts.
Think about countries like Georgia, you know, where they are now saying, well, we've had enough of this. We're not having USAID or National Endowment for Democracy or anybody funding political groups in this country because they're trying to topple our government.
Well, what they said in Georgia was you've got to register as a foreign agent. They didn't say they were going to ban you. You've just got to say where your money comes from.
Everyone's got to be able to see
everybody,
it,
yeah. Everybody's got to be transparent.
And of course, that's the first part of the things that's happened
is that the media in Kyiv, most of which is funded by USAID, suddenly all these journalists have been kicked out of their jobs. And of course, what used to happen is the journalists in Kyiv would be coming out with stuff about, you know, what's going on in the war, blah blah blah, and then Western journalists would take this as kind of, oh right, this is the Ukrainians telling us what's going on. But of course, it's all funded by the Americans, so it's a kind of a loop, like the British funding for the White Helmets in Syria. I mean, where are the White Helmets in Gaza? Yeah, these civil defence people, they're not there at all, are they? Gosh, that's because they're basically a front organisation for MI6, and so they then, you know, present, you know, please intervene in Syria. They're actually on British government payroll.
Has Trump done the right thing here? 9,000 people from USAID have now just been given their P-45.
Well, I think what the problem is, there's some stuff they do which is probably worth doing, and he's got rid of that. Some stuff they do, he's decided he wants to get rid of that. But of course, the Chinese are waiting for him to cut all of this funding for media and helping in the third world, and we'll help them. You don't, you know, if you don't want to help, this is why governments spend money on this stuff, because they're trying to control the rest of the world in
parallel with his policy on tariffs, isn't it? He's not interested in doing anything for these other countries. They've got to come to him. He'll hold the begging bowl out and they can come begging.
Well, I mean, the US is basically saying we are going to do what we need to do for us, and everybody else has got to, you know, has got to suck it up. And of course, the problem from, you know, why the mainstream and Democrat type people in the US are freaking out is because, you know, the American soft power depends upon USAID funding young journalists to criticize the government of Georgia. It's a, you know, it's a career for people, you know. Lots of people in developing countries do the kind of thing we're doing here for nothing. They get paid and they get a career out of it.
Well, that's nice, yeah, but we don't. Matt, what do you think? Has he done the right thing with USAID? 9,000 people. There's only, I think, something like 400 employees left there.
I'm ecstatic. I'm thrilled, yeah. I think it's great. I mean, I'm no doubt that there are some actually good... Well, maybe this is a bit generous, but
sure?
There probably are some
sure?
good things they are doing. As you
yeah,
point.
I mean, there's general aid work which they used yeah. to fund. You know,
well, let's not be naive here. I mean, if you look at their mandate to further U.S. interests, we generally, if you know what's going on in the world, we know what their interests are, and they're interested in themselves. It's consistent. It's naive to think anything else. So I think broadly it seems that, I mean, you look at the fact that within just a few days, Politico has already announced they cannot pay staff. That's just incredible.
Amazing,
to me.
Yeah. Incredible.
That they really are getting that much of a lifeline.
I think we should put up a link on our show page to some of these organisations that are now bleating because of their yep. US State Department funding is gone.
And another
one
of them.
We didn't even know were funded by the US State Department.
No, I didn't realise. Did you guys know how much
I was pretty much aware of it, but not to the detail. What may happen, of course, is Trump.
Have you got any more detail there?
Yeah, well, I've just noticed what The Guardian is saying about it, and it's painting a very negative picture. He's closed USAID, and it just talks about, oh, first the headline is that he's ceding ground to Russia. Now, you yeah, made that okay. point, and look, I'm not saying, like, if you pull back your propaganda apparatus, I suppose, arguably, yeah, it allows another person to make their stories, sure. But, like, the essence of it is that you're pulling back a massive propaganda apparatus, and I listed all the, you know, all the usual suspects, the big media outlets that are, and The Guardian themselves, as I mentioned. So they're complaining about this, they're describing this as ripple effects on aid around the world. And it just makes it try to sound like this benevolent organization.
So maybe
like,
The Guardian would be happy if the Russian embassy called them and said, well, it's okay, we'll give you some money. Whatever you lost from the USAID, we'll replace it and we'll do it. So, this is the hypocrisy of it all. So anyway, what I'd like to do, if it would be really nice on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is put a list of some of the organizations that were being funded through USAID. Anything else you'd like to say before we move on to look at a couple of domestic stories before the break, Matt?
No, but I think it's just in the sense of what Trump is doing. Like I'm left wing. I'm not in favour of neoliberalism, but there is a point at which you go, you know what? They're coming in and they're shaking up this very, very masticised, very, you know, this global reach of this state and deep state mechanism. And shaking it up and tearing it out, and actually that I think is really fantastic. So I think it's like embracing this moment and then being prepared for what's next, and being mindful of all the terrible things that are also, you know, going to result. But generally speaking, Trump is reducing censorship. He's banned federal censorship of social media. That to me is so important.
Well, he's banning the censorship, but he's saying, well, you don't need to censor this because we're starting to take over the world.
You think so? What do you mean? Isn't he? What do you mean? But
don't censor my takeover of the world.
But in what way is he taking it over? If he's reducing the media propaganda,
he's taking over Gaza. He's starting the process of
allegedly
of well,
he may be bluffing on that.
Really?
Well,
you
he's
think
withdrawing
so?
From Syria. And he's
Well, that's what the Israelis said they do. They're not going to do that.
And also, I hear there's a leak apparently that he's going to get out of Ukraine.
No Greenland.
Stop the Ukraine. He's paused funding to Ukraine. He's going to apparently get a deal done, peace deal by Easter. Apparently, that's so.
But anyway, I think you may be right. He may be serious about doing something about digital rights of free speech. He may be serious about that.
Oh no, he signed the executive order.
But only so more people can hear and see him, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean,
what they're going to do is
really?
he's getting rid of all of these Democrat.
That's okay.
Democrat linked stuff. Yeah. He sees this as all Democrat stuff. Yeah. But of course, he's then going to spend money on his stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to fund this lot. He's going to fund his own.
It's a bit like Rupert Murdoch. Yeah. Mm-hmm. His talk TV, talk radio, had a whole show for several years with Richard Tice before he became an MP. Murdoch is giving a show to this guy who is actually really just working for the Israelis now in Parliament. So this is how important. You're absolutely right, Matt. The media is absolutely key in all of this. So people get to know Richard Tice. He seems to have some interesting views on migration and stopping the boats. So maybe they're the right way to go. But then you find out, he's just an Israeli agent. Anyway, look, we're going to move on to look at a couple of domestic stories before the break. Biggie this week is one about small modular reactors. The idea is we're going to clear out it takes probably 3 or 4 acres minimum, up to sort of 10, 15 acres. And you can put a small modular reactor in there, apparently. Put a few pylons, ugly things, you know, the pylons of death, to the local town or the local data centre or data farm or whatever it is you've got, or your farm that's creating vats full of lab-grown chicken. And you can have a reactor run it all. So this is the new plan they seem to have. Let's have a listen to the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, floating this concept and very enthusiastically yesterday.
In 1956, the first nuclear power station, and then, if you can believe it, 21 reactors in less than 10 years. That is an incredible part of our history as a nuclear nation. My frustration, and possibly yours, is that that all then slowed down in the last 15 years or so. It's ground almost to a halt with this sense that nuclear isn't even part of the mix for the future. And I think we've lost opportunities there. I think it's cost us as a nation. And that's what we're turning around. And turning it around in terms of the big decisions we're making that are across the board, whether it comes to planning, innovation, infrastructure, but particularly on nuclear. And I hope we'll have seen some of the material we're putting out today, the statement we're making today, a really important statement, the first national statement since 2011. Seems to me it's long overdue. But really ambitious, which means that we're going for innovation, technology, small modular, which I think will be a huge part of the future that you will all be working on, and of course making it more available in different places. As you know, there's only 8 sites at the moment where we can develop. From today onwards, many other sites can come forward. The potential for that is huge. Because, you know, whether it's in the traditional sectors or whether it's the AI data centers that need to be built, now you can think of the future, which is the reactor there powering the data center. It's going to really transform the way that we go forward. So this is a real game changer when it comes to nuclear. It's part of the bigger story about clean power and making sure that we hit that clean power as we go forward. Nuclear is a part of that. And what that gives us, of course, hugely importantly, is lower bills, stability, because if we push on what you're doing within your sector, it means that we're in control of our energy. It's not subject to international volatility, and Putin can't put his boot on our throat.
So, yes, clean power. Martin, it's not clean, really, nuclear. What do you make of what we're hearing from Starmer here? He's saying that actually we've got some real problems with energy. Massive mobile data, Wi-Fi networks, data centres being created by the tech giants. And actually, if we're not careful, we're going to run out of power. We'll be like South Africa. We'll have to have regular power cuts here.
Well, that is definitely the case. I mean, the energy situation in Europe as a whole has deteriorated very dramatically, and it's not Putin. Putin basically wanted to carry on supplying cheap gas and oil to the Western European countries. It's they have put sanctions on Russia, and the Americans, of course, blew up the pipeline so that they couldn't use it. And that's what's caused the cost of living crisis in this country, is the Americans have sabotaged the European economy quite deliberately.
Matt, this whole thing of green nuclear power, I mean, that to me, from the last century, actually even from the noughties, this is a non sequitur. it. It's not clean. It's extremely dirty. It's extremely dangerous, and it's linked to the nuclear weapons industry.
Yeah, I'm not really qualified to, but I am curious about it. I am open-minded. I used to be very closed-minded to it. I'm more open-minded to it now. I must say, though, that, you know, you should not use this in countries. My father first, just, you know, I was like, no, you cannot build these in countries that are on tectonic plates, like Japan, like New Zealand. Okay. Yeah,
San Francisco.
But, yeah, that's right. But if you, yeah, that is something we must not
have. So what are you going to do with the waste then?
The clean waste. Yeah, I don't know enough about that, you know. But I do see, you know, without diving deeply into it, I do see that they are building different ways of doing it with much less waste. If that's true, then that's interesting.
Well, let's see, because I spoke this week to retired engineer Roy Pumphrey from Stop Hinkley. He had this to say about Starmer's plans for small modular reactors.
The small modular reactor, currently there is no working example anywhere, and Rolls-Royce don't appear to be prepared to do anything until they get paid up front, not just for a prototype and development work, but a contract for a whole lot of them before they'll lift a finger.
So, just imagining that this is a viable design, what would be the main parts of a reactor? What do we need? Obviously, we've got to have a reactor itself with a pressure vessel to contain it, some containment, yes, in case things go wrong. But what are the other things that a reactor needs to work?
Well, you've got to have a lot of... This will still require vast amounts of cooling water, or a tower, a cooling tower, to cool the reactor. And you will still have to have all the things like the turbine hall, a small version of that. You will have to have a good grid connection, so there'll be a substation and pylons and cable to get electricity to wherever it's then going to get distributed and into people's homes, do something useful. It's going to require duplication of a complicated process. It will also require, I imagine, that the regulator will have to give its seal of approval to the design in the first instance, but then each individual site will have to meet Office of Nuclear Regulation ground rules for health and safety and being in a sensible place to be, and guarantee of the cooling water supply is going to be a major part of that.
Do you think this will ever happen?
No. No, I don't. I think the other ways in which electricity can be generated are much cheaper, quicker, and simpler to build, and I think this is not a good way to be going forward. I notice again, the government promotes the idea that there are thousands of skilled jobs with this. There are a variety of jobs, some more skilled, some less skilled, in building a nuclear power station, as we're seeing here at Hinkley. And the whole point about that none of them last a considerable period of time. The number of people, there are only a few people working at Hinkley Point C now who were there when it started. And the majority, it's a moving feast. People come and go. And the information I have is that because of working conditions, the actual turnover in workers at the site is also quite enormous. So it's not like the battery factory that's also going to happen just outside Bridgewater, for electric car batteries, which is a much more predictable, stable and permanent employment for people compared to building a nuclear power station, because it takes precious few people to actually operate one.
So that's Roy Pumphrey from Stop Hinkley. speaking to me earlier this week. He also goes on, I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the full interview. He also speaks at great length about the alternatives to nuclear, which he's suggesting are far cheaper and actually genuinely clean, whereas, of course, it's a complete and utter bald-faced lie to say that nuclear is in any way clean. It's extremely dirty, particularly if you've ever been close to one of these nuclear flasks, as it's being taken from one of the power stations up to Sellafield. The other thing which you need to look at if you want to think, is this clean or dirty, is Sellafield itself, where they do the reprocessing of the fuel rods from these power stations. It's a total disaster, and it's actually their full-time job to try and keep everyone out and away from it so that no one can see what's going on at Sellafield. There are all sorts of tasks that are almost impossible to perform with this waste, because the whole plant is having immense problems in actually dealing with the waste that keeps turning up there. And this is a complete taboo, which isn't really being dealt with at all by government. Anyway, Martin, his attitude, what he's saying, Roy, is saying no. He doesn't really actually believe it's going to happen. And you can say the same for Hinkley C. When this was originally, we were originally told this was going to happen back in 2013. This is, that's quite getting on a bit now, isn't it? It's nearly 15 years since it was first commissioned. They're now saying it's going to be after 2030 when Hinkley C is even switched on, if it ever is.
Well, that's right, and that's a conventional, large-scale nuclear power station. I think it's a lot of this is just pie in the sky. I mean, what are the economics of this? I mean, how's it going to be made to pay? As Roy said, Rolls-Royce won't pay do anything for this unless they're given a huge contract in advance by the government. So it'll have to be government money behind it. Now, apparently, we haven't got any money. I can't see a dentist, and we can't afford to heat pensioners' homes, and we've got to raise taxes on farmers. But we're still going to find money for these little reactors. Where's that going to come from? I don't think there is any, is there? We could print the money. We could nationalise the banking system. We could have socialism and reactors. Or maybe it's just a load of pie in the sky. Can you really see that they're going to carry out a programme like that? I don't think they are. They're just talking out of their backsides, aren't they?
Yeah, I think you might be right. And the idea, I think, is we've got to talk. The idea, I think, that there seems to be coming out of the Treasury at the moment, maybe with Larry Fink's little office that he's now got from BlackRock inside the Treasury, is they're saying, well, we've got to be very positive, and this is part of the way that growth happens, is that you get the politicians giving lots of ideas that lots of positive things are happening. It doesn't really matter, like Hinkley. It doesn't really matter whether it ever happens or not. You've just got to put on the appearance of lots of successful developments going on, so that will attract investment. Maybe that's what's going on.
Well, I mean, the idea of attracting investment is because the government doesn't want to invest itself. I mean, what if you really wanted to reboot the British economy, the government would have to invest a lot of money in doing that. Nothing wrong with that. But it's not capitalism as we know it. What they're saying is that capitalists are going to do this to make money for themselves, but they can't see any money in it. I mean, they've tried, the nuclear power has been an economic white elephant from the very beginning. The only reason why we've got any nuclear power at all is because the nuclear weapons industry, they needed a spin-off, and that's what nuclear power
was. Well, a lot of the farmers...
But it's not viable.
The farmers have been getting a little bit peeved about this. They're saying, well, so you're trying to bankrupt us, so we have to sell our farmland so you can put small modular reactors on there and do other things as well. So, anyway, there's another demonstration taking place on Monday in central London. If you want to go and see a farmer, or there's probably some young tractor spotters around, they're going to be giving, I think, a prize for the oldest tractor in the close down of Whitehall, as the farmers are going to do again once more on Monday.
We'll be back in London next Monday, the 10th of Feb. The guys at Save British Farming are staging another tractor rally in Westminster to amplify the parliamentary debate on the family farm tax, which is happening on the same day. The petition to stop the tax changes already has around, I think it's about 150,000 signatures, and that number is growing every day. So yeah, the rally on Monday is to coincide with that debate, and it's being called Change Your Tune Starmer. I was very kindly asked if I would come down and perform my song, and seeing as I was going to go down anyway, it seemed like a no-brainer. So back off Starmer, I Wanna Be a Farmer is going to get its live its live debut. Well, I say debut, it's probably the only time you'll ever see it performed. So yeah, me and Dad, we're going to go down together, my guitar in hand. There's going to be a lot of people, I guess, arriving in tractors. I think there's a lot of tractors expected, and probably quite a lot of foot traffic as well. So yeah, if you're coming along, then I'll see you there. If not, then I hope you can support us all in spirit while we continue to fight to make our voices heard. If you want to read more about the day and what'll be happening, I'll put a link down below so you can go and check that out. I think the idea is that there'll be some speeches and some music and whatnot, and then a live broadcast of the debate as it happens in Parliament. I think there's also going to be a prize for the oldest tractor. So yeah, it should be a good day and for a good cause. So onwards and upwards.
Back off Starmer, I Want to Be a Farmer.
I wanted to ask you, what did the gentleman you put on before him say were the alternatives that he believed would be the better, cleaner energy options?
Well, no, of course you can ask that. Yeah, yeah. I love being asked questions. Yes. Please do, put me on the spot. Yes. Yeah, I don't mind
turn
at all. No, he was, what he's saying is, and I would 100% agree with him, is that you've got the highest tidal range anywhere in the world here in the Bristol Channel. Let's have some turbines under the Severn Bridge and around that sort of area. In fact, if you've not done it yet, you can walk over the Severn Bridge or cycle over there and stop halfway. This is the old Severn Bridge. You can't do it with the new one, the Prince of Wales Antichrist Bridge, we call it, as we drive over it. But anyway, the old one, you can stand there and look down and you will see masses and masses of water churning backwards and forwards, and forwards every day. So I sat down, I can't remember the guy's name, from Chipping Norton, I think he was. Can't remember. Anyway, I sat down and did an interview with him probably 10, 12 years ago about the viability and finances of tidal power, because they're already doing it up in the north of Scotland. So what you would end up getting was be about twice as much. I mean, depending on obviously how big the scheme is, you get around about twice as much power as you do from Hinkley C, but around about half the cost, and also none of the radiation everywhere afterwards. So, wow. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it sounds brilliant.
I think it would work. But anyway, thanks, Matt. And we'll be picking up on, all sorts, particularly to do with Donald Trump, and also looking at a particular sort of look straight at Canadian politics and what's happening with the departure of Trudeau after the break. That's from 1972, Deep Purple. I love that. I don't know why, how they managed to do that. It's almost like it's kind of classically, maybe they classically trained some of them. That was Deep Purple from Sheffield from 1972, and My Woman from Tokyo. And before that, we had Yes, Owner of a Lonely Heart. That's 1983. And the beginning, the good old kiddie choir of Guildford Cathedral, At the Name of Jesus. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to start by having a good old look at Canada, because there's all sorts of political changes going on there, Martin. What do you make of the departure of Justin Trudeau? He's actually himself. I mean, they say there is no such thing as a nobility in Canada, but actually there is, isn't there? I mean, he's from a dynasty.
Well, he is. I mean, his father, Pierre Trudeau, for example, did not, Canadian troops did not participate in the 2003 invasion of Iraq, nor did Germans or French. The British did, Australians did, but no other Commonwealth countries participated. And that was Canada's position of his father. But of course, the Liberal Party has become a neoliberal party. So they used to have some kind of, social democratic tendencies, but that's all gone. And their popularity has collapsed as a result of, you know, the fact that they've been in power too long and everybody's fed up with them.
Popularity, does that really matter nowadays? Surely they can just spin their way into the future, can't they? Do they really need to be popular?
Well, I mean, you've got to keep people on side. If you're going to get rid of one lot of politicians, the powers that be need another lot of politicians to get everybody
happy. Yeah, this happened actually in New Zealand with Jacinda Ardern. Her popularity is starting to slide. The same obviously has happened here in particularly with Rishi Sunak in our last general election. His approval ratings. I mean, I never quite understood why Boris Johnson got such high approval ratings, even though he was such a silly chap, should we say. But Sunak had no pretensions to having high approval ratings. And it seemed to me he was kind of a Trojan horse to drag the Conservative Party into utter defeat, you know, somehow. But anyway, so Chrystia Freeland, or Chrystia, I think it is, Freeland. What do you make of her? She's just waiting in the wings. It looks like she, or either her, or amazingly, Mark Carney. Now, Mark Carney is a major Bilderberger. I remember him at the Lisbon Bilderberg Conference a couple of years ago, shouting out at the top of my voice, "Hi, Mark!" like this, and of course he walks straight on because he knows that I really just want him to turn around so I can get his photo of his face. And he sort of just carried on walking, and so I shouted out even louder. I said, "Don't you know your own name?" And you could see him just sort of trying to ignore these annoying people there. But Mark Carney is also in the running to be the Canadian boss, president. So,
not president.
Prime Minister. So, anyway, what about Chrystia Freeland?
Well, she's...
Freeland.
Yeah, she is the granddaughter of a Ukrainian Nazi. So that's her background. And there's quite a big Ukrainian a lot of Ukraine Banderistas were taken from Ukraine at the end of the war and resettled in Canada. So you've actually got that's how we ended up with that guy who was actually in the SS being cheered and clapped in the parliament with Justin Trudeau, who's supposedly a Liberal prime minister.
Yeah. We had a similar thing with Boris in the British Parliament, didn't we? But not quite so absolutely blatant in front of everybody. Anyway, let's have a listen now to John Bosnich. He's a fascinating guy I came across a couple of years ago. And John is Serbian blood, but born in Canada because his family were out there in exile. And he goes between the two. He also worked as an advisor for the Japanese government a few years ago. But anyway, see what he's got to say about Chrystia Freeland, and also this guy Mark Carney. Will they be taking over as Prime Minister over in Canada?
Who is Chrystia Freeland? Well, Chrystia Freeland is the Nazi princess. What's that? The granddaughter of the main Nazi World War II Nazi Ukrainian publisher in the Nazi-occupied Ukraine. The SS Galicia, the SS unit Galicia, which is the western edge of Ukraine, which used to be Polish. Remember, Taras Bulba fought the Poles. Well, that was seized from Poland by Stalin after World War II. The western part of Ukraine is actually Polish. Lvov, now called Lviv, by the same guys who try and write Kiev and write with two Y's at the end of their name to pretend they're something different. The western edge of Ukraine is not Ukraine. It's pure Poland, and it will be returned to Poland, mark my words. Well, these guys move in Ukraine via this system, and they use the Poles to create the Nazis, because the Poles, you know who Hitler was jealous of right before 1939, September 1939? He was jealous of the fascist dictator of Poland, Piłsudski, who he had emulated. And when that dictator of Poland died, Poland was leaderless and Hitler massacred them in the Blitzkrieg. So the Poles have a long history of fascism. And that fascism was reflected by Zbigniew Brzeziński, my father's classmate and roommate, and by the appointment of the Polish Pope, to create the NATO-Nazi attack on Russia, who the Poles hate. Solidarity was set up by the Solidarity Labor Union with Lech Walesa, set up directly by the CIA. The Polish Pope, set up directly by the CIA, dictated to the so-called Holy Synod in the Vatican. All of this is string pulled by the politicians in America, who actually are just actors. They're just actors who are remote controlled by their advisors. Well, who are the advisors? Well, first of all, Chrystia Freeland became the prime minister's number two in Canada. Well, no, she's not the number two, bro. She is the puppeteer, the ventriloquist who was running Justin Trudeau. That was Chrystia Freeland's daily job. Watch Trudeau, tell him what to do. She was deputy prime minister and finance minister. In other words, she had the purse strings. She basically had Justin Trudeau by the balls, if he has any. She ran the government. When it was obvious that Trudeau was going to lose and be removed, she resigned, attacked Trudeau, criticized Trudeau to try and wash her hands like Pontius Pilate of Trudeau, let him go down to defeat so she could inherit the government of Canada as the globalist candidate. And naturally, every good globalist was the descendant of a former Nazi, the globalist fascist movement, which was financed by the banksters, not just non-Jewish banksters. Jewish banksters financed Hitler. So this all brings the closed circle of how a Jewish president can work with Nazis. Easy. Jewish banksters were financing Nazis from World War II and before. They, in fact, financed Mussolini, the first fascist leader. So this is the closed circle, because Jewish banksters' allegiance is not to the Jewish people. Their allegiance is to Mammon. Read the Old Testament and you'll learn all about it. So this is the picture that we've got here. We are just a cog in the globalist wheel. Justin Trudeau was the candidate. He's now fallen. So their new candidates are two new globalists. Here they are. Chrystia Freeland, Nazi princess, and the founder or one of the key members of a group called, and I was invited to join this group, and I almost did in the 1980s. It was called the Federation or the Alliance of Captured Nations, which was a hardcore anti-Soviet organization in Canada and the United States, which people joined to try to liberate their homelands or their ancestral homelands, because I wasn't even born in Serbia. I was born in Canada in exile, to try to liberate those territories from the Soviet Union. Naive people like myself thought we were liberating it to bring democracy, but the CIA that set up the Association of Captured Nations actually wanted fascists. They wanted to reimpose fascists like Adolf Hitler, like Zelensky, who is the cover man for fascism. Why did they pick a nominal Jew to lead their movement? Because they thought nobody in the world could ever accuse us of being fascists if the man we put in office is himself a Jew. This is how it's done. This has been an amazing job. And who are the people around this? Well, Anthony Blinken. Oh, what a coincidence. Freeland is the foreign minister of Canada and then later the finance minister of Canada and the deputy prime minister. So the right-hand man, i.e. she's a woman, but the right-hand man of Canada is Freeland. This is a person of Nazi descent from Ukraine. Who is the right-hand man in America? Anthony Blinken. It's not Anthony Blinken. It's Antony Blinken. I wonder what the origin of Antony is. Ah, he's a Jew from Ukraine. So the Ukrainian Jewish lobby, along with the Ukrainian Nazi lobby, the Nazis take the right-hand seat in Canada, and the Jewish lobby from Ukraine puts Blinken in the right-hand seat as Foreign Secretary, Secretary of State of America. And who does Blinken assign to stage the $5 million Maidan coup against the democratically elected president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, who wanted to do a deal with Russia? Well, of course, they send Victoria Nuland. Who is Victoria Nuland? Victoria Nuland is a Jew from Ukraine. So we got Freeland, Nazi from Ukraine. Newland, Jew from Ukraine. Blinken, Jew from Ukraine. Are these things starting to piece together for you? And who was in the whole planning of this way back in the 1970s, who explained this plot to my father, his roommate, none other than Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is a Pole who wanted to return to Poland, the western edge of Ukraine. So this thing has been in the works since the early 1970s, and it is culminating today. Mark Carney, who is this guy? Well, Mark Carney is a globalist bankster who was the Bank of England governor and previously the Bank of Canada governor. And this guy is the guy who works with the Federal Reserve. Well, you might have been hearing a little bit of friction between Donald Trump, and the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve chairman gave an interview a couple of days ago. Of course, the Federal Reserve was created around the time of World War I, when the United States became a world power, because the international bankster cartel was not about to allow a superpower to not have its money under their control. So they forced through the creation of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has, I can't remember if it's 9 or 11 members. Nine of the 11 members are Jewish banksters. Two of the 11 members, one is a token black, just like they say on South Park, the television program. He's the token black, and I can't remember who the other is. So you've got a Federal Reserve controlled by private Jewish bankers. And who are those banker families that run the Federal Reserve? Well, guess what? Those are the Jewish bankers who jumped out of Germany when Germany collapsed. They went after the German Empire collapsed because they were called Hochjuden, high Jews or court Jews. One of them is Rothschild. Rothschild was created a baron. There's a wine named for him, Baron Rothschild's white wine and red wine. He was one of the Hochjuden. What were the Hochjuden? Well, because of Christianity, we couldn't charge when people were actually Christians. They were Catholics all across Europe. And it said right in the Bible, you couldn't charge interest. But if you can't charge interest, you can't make profit. You can't make money. So all of the princes of Germany needed to have in their employ, in addition to a court jester, to keep them smart, because most of them were inbred and stupid. In addition to a court jester, they had what was called a high Jew, or in German, in the original German, Hochjuden. This is a bankster takeover of the Western world. The banksters are taking over. Mandelson is a bankster. He is a Jewish bankster. He is going to take over your country. That is their effort. That is their aim. If they fail this time, they will try again. These are not hazard. These are not random events. This is the way the world is being run. And I remember when I started to learn about these things, who did I learn from? Who taught me this? Well, my father was very, very well educated, spoke 8 languages, and taught me everything that you could find in print on these subjects. He refused the 4th generation in a row invitation to become a Freemason. I've also been invited 5 times. All of us have refused this. This is the entry gateway to the bankster society. But who was it that taught me? Well, when I was a student radical at my university, an old man, short, small, with a very big nose, typical Jewish guy, came up to me and he said, "Are you the student union president, Mr. Bosnich?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm Morris Spiro, and I need to talk to you." And Morris Spiro was the communist younger brother of their rabbi of Fredericton. And Morris told me everything about the Jewish banksters who he hated. He told me all of this. And when I went to Serbia, after leaving Canada, after being expelled from university, after putting the police in jail, I had to leave the country. When I went to Serbia to basically save my life, I come to Serbia And I'm at a press conference where the only other anti-NATO questioner, all the media in Serbia had already been taken over by Soros, Jewish bankster, who had taken over the media in the country of Serbia right before NATO bombed. I go to a press conference. There's 100 reporters there. They're all anti-Serb. They're all pro-NATO, except for one, a small, obviously Jewish little man named Mateo Bojanovic Halpern, who became my close partner. Why? Because Mateo was another communist Jew who told me the inside story of how the United States Empire operates and how the Jewish bankers operate. And it has nothing to do with being Jewish of religion. They don't believe in their religion. These are people whose identity is adopted Judaism from Khazaria. These are the Khazarian bankster Jews who are not blood Jews, not Hebraic in origin. These are the people who run the Western world, and they do so arm in arm with fellow non-Hebraic Nazis like Chrystia Freeland, like Anthony Blinken. He's a Jew who worked with the Nazis, the NATO Nazis, and this is the paradigm in which we live.
So that's John Bosnich there speaking to me yesterday about Canadian politics. Obviously, he goes off on all sorts of tangents there, but I think fair play to him. Some very interesting ones too. And he's talking also, Martin, about the whole situation in his native Yugoslavia, Bosnia, from those times where you were, of course, as well. So I wonder what you make of this this sort of bankster Jewish element that he's, I mean, I suppose it's a kind of Jewish mafia, maybe, but he's making absolutely clear this, that they're not interested in the religion. This is just a name that they use, and that they're originally Khazarian.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of historical references, as you say, that Khazaria was an interesting thing because it was that they converted to Judaism in about the 9th century AD, and they weren't Jewish originally, but they had the Constantinople, the Orthodox Empire, and they had Muslims coming from the steppes. So they wanted to have a...
This is the Byzantine Empire.
Yes, Byzantine Empire. So they're trying to think about, we need to have a religion, because of course before that they'd just been shamanistic.
Well, he actually takes us through the story of how they decided to embrace Judaism and why.
People decided to convert to Christianity at about the same sort of period.
If you enjoyed
Ethelbert and so on.
If you enjoyed that, then there's about another hour and three quarters of John speaking. As I did try and let him just carry on because I found what he was saying so fascinating. So let's have a listen to him now again here talking about what we were hearing about earlier, which is Donald Trump's real estate project in Gaza.
Trump wants to turn it over to a Jewish-financed real estate project. And Trump, you know what? Here in Canada, we'd say Trump doesn't give a flying F. He doesn't care. He's set for life. He's financed by Adelson, who runs the casinos in Las Vegas. He has unlimited cash. He's married his daughter off to a leading Zionist activist. He sold his soul to the people who paid for it. And when Trump says he's America first, well, there are a lot of us out here who strongly support Trump. I can tell you about that, a paradoxical stand. I strongly support Trump. Why? Because Trump is pulling off all the curtains. He's pulling back the curtains. He's letting you see the Wizard of Oz. He's letting you see who runs it all. That's what Trump's value is. He can't keep a secret. Trump is working for the Israel Zionist lobby, and he's admitted it. And it's not America first. It's Zion first.
No, well, this is epic stuff. This is epic stuff, John. But quite clearly, the Chinese and the Russians are superpowers. They're not just going to simply allow this to roll over, are they?
No, they aren't. But watch out, because the Chinese are the Asian version of the Jews. They are industrious. They are very good businessmen. They are amazing traders. And the Jewish capital, once again, it's a play on words and terms. It is not Jewish capital. It is Khazar bankster capital. These people do not believe in God. They are not Jews. To be a Jew, you must believe in God. That is the definition of
a Jew. You seem to be implying here the Chinese and the Americans. I suppose maybe with Wuhan, you might be right, but they're working together. They're both godless.
Not yet. Not yet. But I can tell you that the biggest financial transfer after the Jews of Germany moved to London, the city of London, which they controlled, and then when they moved from London to New York, after the British Empire had the sun set on it, they moved to where the new capital of the world empire was. That's New York, not Washington. Money talks, not some puppet, not some actor in the White House. And now they're in the process, in the biggest capital transfer in the history of the human race, they're in the process of moving to Shanghai. And when the Jewish, not Jewish, sorry, Khazar pseudo-Jewish banksters who do not believe in God and do not believe in Judaism, when they transfer their cash to Shanghai, the capital of the world empire will be in China. And that's how history goes. And that is, you can trace it through history. There is no break in this chain. This is the way this world is run, and I'm looking forward to seeing Musk get us to Mars, because there is a hope that maybe if we get to a new planet, we can do it differently.
But you're saying there is no hope down here then? That's a bit bleak, isn't it? The Orthodox Church wouldn't agree.
It's not no hope. It's not no hope.
Well, the Orthodox Church wouldn't agree with you. They'd say, Revelation, the Book of Revelation tells us what's going to happen. There's going to be an almighty fight.
That's correct.
And God will win.
That is correct, and I believe in that. But until that fight happens, we are in this trap. And this is why I'm speaking openly about this. I know I am not anti-Semitic. Not only do I not dislike Arabs, I also do not dislike Jews. It is not the average Hebraic normal Jew who is responsible for any of this. My first girlfriend was a Jew. My father's first girlfriend was a Jew. My financial supporters have always been Jews. My collaborators in school have been Jews. They're better educated. They are multilingual. These are an elite group of human beings. But it is the subset of that elite group of super powerful, super educated individuals that has adopted their name and their religion and their identity, who are not Hebraic, who are not Hebrews, who are Khazars, who are Turks. They are the ones who are trying to pull off this global putch via your pocketbook.
See. I mean, I don't think they're going to succeed. The Book of Revelation talks about something called the Synagogue of Satan, doesn't it?
Yes. I can tell you, Tony, that, you know, every believing Christian and every believing Jew follows the same book, at least the first part of that book, and it clearly states, and in all other Jewish writings, Judaic religious writings, it clearly states that the kingdom of Israel based at Jerusalem can only, not somewhat, only be restored when the Messiah returns. And let me tell you, Netanyahu is not the Messiah, and Donald Trump is not the Messiah. And if these two are creating the state of Israel with a capital at Jerusalem, they are not acting in the name of the Messiah. They are acting in the name of the Messiah's enemy. They are acting in the name of the imposter. They are acting in the name of Satan. That's what's happening.
Yeah, and the Antichrist, possibly. That's obviously, many Jews,
correct,
maybe particularly ones that aren't following biblical stuff at all, they are hoping, they're looking at their watches, aren't they? Where is this Messiah of ours? It obviously wasn't Jesus. We're still waiting. And so by imposing a Messiah, that could, of course, become an Antichrist figure.
And then there will be the Armageddon, in which God, the real living God, the God of all Jews, the God of all Arabs, the God of all Muslims, the God of all Hindus, the God of all Christians, the God of all gods, the one God, will crush the Antichrist and crush Satan and bring the kingdom of heaven that imaginary place, a Garden of Eden in the sky where we think our souls go, he will bring it down to this earth, raise the dead, and we will all live on peace in the one and only inhabited speck of dust in the entire known universe.
Well, I must admit, I wasn't expecting it to head in that sort of direction. I mean, what he's saying, Martin, I suppose, here is that, that what's going on in the Middle East is of epic proportions. And quite a few commentators have talked about this as a sort of biblical thing, using these terms like Armageddon, that sort of thing. It does make you wonder where this is all heading, what, particularly with the Israelis having their nukes.
Well, yes. I mean, don't forget, I mean, the whole of our culture is saturated with all of this kind of stuff. I mean, you know, secularism is a relatively recent phenomenon.
Well, yeah, but this is happening now. Look, well, I mean, this is a disingenuous thing to say, because there's absolutely nothing about this in the mainstream press, really. The Daily Express might have something talking about Armageddon, maybe. But there's no looking at this from a scriptural or biblical, spiritual point of view, really.
It depends who you're talking to, doesn't it? I mean, you know, some people...
Oh, there's out there on the internet,
there's
sure.
There's plenty of people out there who, from various, you know, whether they're Muslims, Christians, or Jews, who interpret the world using these kind of, you know, the biblical, you know, these ancient texts. They've been absolutely... Our culture is saturated at the deepest level with this stuff. So, of course, it's very hard to disentangle what's actually going on from people's perceptions of what's going on to do with everything that they've been brought up to believe. I mean, the Book of Revelation has obviously have been hugely influential in shaping all sorts of different ideologies and people's ways of looking at things. I'm prepared to listen to anything, but at the end of the day, I think it's a lot of things are actually unpredictable.
Well, in a way,
unpredictable in ways.
In a way,
where, you know, something may happen which has nothing to do with that at all.
Yes,
we may be hit by an asteroid.
But what do you make of
nothing
John,
to do
John's,
with anything in the Book of Revelation?
John, funnily enough, he talks about that, but in the longer interview at thisweek.org.uk, which I'll put up later, that's John Bosnich. But Martin, what about his point about the sort of this link up between Jews and Nazis, and this idea that we're actually using the term Jew is actually really a con?
Well, I mean, Judaism is a religion rather than a racial category, as he pointed out. I mean, Soros, apparently, I don't know the full detail, but people have researched it, he was actually involved in dispossessing Jews in Hungary.
That's right, he was.
Yeah, when he was a young man.
Yeah, we've played that clip a few times, actually.
Yes, and so what you've actually got is...
He says it himself, yeah.
Well, most criminal fraternities are based on some kind of ethnic solidarity. So, the Camorra and the Ndrangheta in Italy are Italians. But of course, Lucky Luciano was in prison in New York, was released by the Americans, and they used him to try and control Italy after they invaded and took it over in the 1940s. But of course, there's also, Meyer Lansky was the head of the mafia in the United States, and he was Jewish. And of course, the Las Vegas was created by him. And of course, the Adelsons, Sheldon's dead now, but his wife's still there. They are essentially gangsters. But they're Jewish gangsters. But not all gangsters are Jews, and not all Jews are gangsters.
No.
I think the fact is...
But he's made that pretty clear.
Well, I mean, it's what you're dealing with here is people... behaving badly because they can.
I rather like the sound of these communist Jews, I must say. Anyway, look, what about the final clip from John Bosnich? And I put it to him that the Canadians had better watch out because Donald Trump is looking to impose tariffs on them, on Canada, and to start a sort of trade war, even though he might just be bluffing. You know, Trump's booked the art of the deal. Maybe he's just trying to do a deal and bluffing. So what does he think about the idea of tariffs on Canada?
Less than 10,000 people run this world, and I know that, Tony, because, these are all what my grandmother, my Serbian grandmother, who was a multimillionaire, one of the very few multimillionaires in Serbia before World War I, She went to study esoteric sciences in Budapest during the time that her area of the country was in Austro-Hungary, and she was taught to read crystal balls and tarot cards and all by the biggest scientists of Austro-Hungarian Empire. So, Tony, I was born on the National Day of Serbia, in Canada, in exile, during a 100% eclipse of the sun directly over Kosovo. Okay? My grandmother told me at age 5, John, she spoke to me in English. I didn't speak Serbian. She said, John, you will marry a Serbian girl. You will have Serbian sons. You will return to Serbia and you will aid in the battle to free Serbia. And during your lifetime, Serbia will be free. This is your future.
Pleasure. Thank you for all your predictions about Canada and an insight into what's actually going on.
I strongly support Trump's sanctions. I want my native Canada to be a free country. I want 2,000% sanctions. I want to stop selling our oil and gas for cents on the dollar to America. I want us to be a free, bilingual country with a multicultural society that is not all huddled 100 miles from the U.S. border. Let's bring it on. Trump, kick us out of the nest. Be the mother bird. Kick us out so we fly or die. Let's do it.
John Bosnich there. I put the full interview up nearly 2 hours altogether, but absolutely fascinating bit of history. I mean, personally about him, but also a lot about the bankster class and the Nazis working together to control the Western world, controlling all sorts, actually. So fascinating, John Bosnich. Martin, what about this idea of bring it on? Yeah, with the sanctions, he's saying actually this is we've been talking about this with Russia, haven't we? That the Russians have actually had a bit of an mini economic miracle. They've had to start up a whole load of industries which they didn't think they were going to have to, and they've done rather well.
They have, but I mean, Canada is in a weaker position than Russia is. But nevertheless, I mean, the idea. I mean, you feel like saying to Trump, if you had all these Canadians in the United States and there was an election, they wouldn't vote for you. So you know, and of course, they're talking about Mexico taking over Mexico as well. This is. Well, I mean, what will happen, Michael Hudson, the economist, the US economist, is pointing out that what will probably happen as a result of what Trump is doing with the tariffs and all the rest of it, he's going to crash the stock market and create a Great Depression. That's why the business class are freaking out about him, because he don't really know what he's doing. The consequences of breaking all these supply chains in a disorderly fashion this could blow up the derivatives bomb, which has been ticking away since 2008 underneath the whole of the financial system. Why does he think that he can just chuck his weight about and it won't just go down the drain? And of course, if it goes down the drain, then I think we're going to have a simultaneous financial crash and world war at the same time, which is what happened in World War One.
Before we go to Andy Gordon to get a report from some of the geopolitics going on in the Pacific Islands from New Zealand, what about today we hear that Trump saying that Israel is going to hand Gaza over to the US after fighting. I'm not sure if the Israelis have all agreed to that, but I mean, also it's rather bizarre to have them also saying that no US troops will be involved, it will just be Israeli troops. I mean, they're basically, seems to me, with Trump in charge, they're both the same country now. One of the Israeli ministers has ordered the military to prepare the departure of all Gaza's Palestinians, Martin.
Yeah, but where are they going to go? I mean, the Egyptians have said that they won't have them. Jordanians have said that they won't have them. And, of course, they're saying, well, some minister in the Israeli government was saying all the countries that have criticised our attack on Gaza, they should take the Palestinians. And I think, feel like saying, well, you know, maybe they should all go to New York. Yeah? Maybe that's what they need to do. All the Palestinians go to New York, 2.5 million of them.
The Turks are also considering building military bases in Syria now?
Well, they are, yes. And, of course, what may happen then is you end up with a situation where the Israelis are facing off against Turkey. Now, Turkey is a much better armed opponent than Syria was. And, you know, if Turkey goes to war with Israel, Israel will probably lose.
Yeah, the new Syrian army's also been, apparently, I don't know if Craig Murray's picked up on this, probably good to have a look at him, but they're saying that this new ISIS that's now taken over Syria is now invading Lebanon today.
Yes, So, in other words, this is all part of the Yinon plan, from the 1980s to balkanize or break up all the neighboring states surrounding Israel, and therefore, control the Middle East. But, of course, it's a reckless plan. And the likelihood is there's so many things to go wrong. They're talking now about Gaza, who's going to have it, will it be the Americans have it, or will the Israelis have it? I'll tell you who's controlling Gaza as we speak. The Al-Qassam brigades of Hamas, who have got more people recruited now than they had at the beginning of the fight.
That's right.
And these young boys, they're only young, most of them, they're all well-trained now, and they know exactly what they're doing, and nobody is going to defeat them.
Do you think that Trump and Netanyahu are just going to wait for all these Hamas hostages to be released and then just resume the massacre?
If Hamas are sensible, they're going to keep hold of the male soldiers. They're not going to release them, and they won't get them back. So once Hamas have released all of their, they're not hostages, they're prisoners of war. If you are a soldier, you're not a hostage, you're a POW.
No,
and they will hang on to them, because they know very well that as soon as the last one's handed over, then the other side are going to go back to killing everybody. So that, and of course, everybody said that nobody's going to negotiate with Hamas. They've just got to be smashed. Hang on a minute, you've just negotiated with
them. Hamas has been doubled in strength and size.
We're talking about the military wing of Hamas. I mean, they've killed loads and loads of civilians, but they haven't defeated Hamas militarily at all. And in fact, they're probably in a better position now than they were at the beginning, because they've got all of the unexploded ordnance, which is in the rubble. They're picking that out and turning it into improvised explosive devices.
Let's just take a step back from this and think of what's been going on here. This, if this is allowed to continue, this US-Israeli genocide, takeover of Lebanon, destruction of Syria, basically taking over all these lands, this is going to be like a cancer, isn't it? It's going to spread and spread. It'll be spread across the Middle East, possibly even across the world.
Yes, I mean, there's so many things to go wrong here, isn't there? But, of course, the obvious thing that may well happen is that they do go to war with Iran, and, of course, Iran will give a good account of itself. The Iranians are not a pushover. Of course they're not. Their missiles that they fired into Israel were just a demonstration of what they could do. And, of course, what they should do is they should just smash the Israeli Defense Forces. It would take a couple of months, rain missiles down on them and kill them all.
This is a bit naive of you to think that they would just fall into that trap. That's exactly what Trump and Netanyahu
want. Well, no, they can fire back.
Trump and Netanyahu want to start a major war. That's exactly what they want.
Yes, and the Iranians don't want a war for very sensible reasons. Yeah. But sometimes you have to fight one, like Britain had to do in World War II.
Israel has apparently crossed all the red lines, apparently.
Well, at the moment, the Iranians are quite happy with the ceasefire, because it means that Anas Rullah in Yemen, they've recognised the ceasefire. But of course, as soon as the ceasefire breaks down, then we're back to war.
Anyway, we're concentrating lots and lots for months and months, of course, quite rightly, on the Middle East. But what about the Pacific Islands? China and the AUKUS countries, that is Australia, New Zealand, and a few others, all sorts is going on over there, as was explained to me this week by Andy Gordon over in Dunedin in New Zealand.
There's been quite a few geopolitical moves in the Pacific on these islands by China. And a few years ago, they signed an agreement with Kiribati Islands. And, since that time, America and New Zealand and Australia have all started to get really worried about this. And they've been piling money into the other islands to try and stop them signing with China. And obviously they're using these moves by China as an excuse to expand their own military presence, on the islands and in the Pacific in general, And since Kiribati has signed this agreement with China, there's been the Solomon Islands, which have also signed up to an agreement with China. And these agreements include defense of the islands if there's trouble, So there is a military aspect to it. But in some respects, I think that military aspect to it you know, they've kind of just copied the old agreement which they had with New Zealand, let's say, you know, or Australia or the US. So, yeah, there's some very interesting moves being made. And just this week, there's talk of the Cook Islands going over to sign an agreement with China. And obviously that's got the Kiwis backs right up because, you know, the Cook Islands is basically New Zealand. They don't have their own passport. They use New Zealand passports. They've got a right to New Zealand passports and they've got a right to come to New Zealand anytime they feel free, you know. So there's a massive debate going on now between New Zealand and the Cook Islands that, you know, New Zealand's basically threatening that they're going to take away their passports, Kiwi passports and the rights to come here. So, yeah, it's quite concerning from New Zealand's point of view, this one, although apparently the Cook Islands are not going to sign any military agreement with China. So, you know, the Cook Islanders are trying to have it both ways in some ways. They want to introduce their own passport and still have the right to a New Zealand passport. And they also want New Zealand to defend them, you know, even though they're signing this agreement with China. So, yeah, it's an interesting situation.
Now, it really is. And just from a sort of geographical point of view, trying to understand what the map looks like, you know, obviously you've got Australia and New Zealand. To the north and northeast in the Pacific there, you've got a whole load of different island groups from sort of working your way across from the west to the east. You've got the Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, New Caledonia, which are... I'm not sure who controls the Solomon Islands, but that's French, New Caledonia. Plus, you've got then Fiji, which is independent. Plus, you've got more French islands, the Wallis and the Futuna Islands. You've got Samoa, American Samoa, Tonga, and the Cook Islands. It says on the map of New Zealand anyway, and then French Polynesia. Above that, to the north, you've got the Marshall Islands, the Mariana Islands. But there's a hell of a lot out there, and it just seems to me amazing that the New Zealanders and the West generally seem to be prepared for the Chinese to come along, do investment deals, and they're not actually trying to compete with them. In fact, what they rather than trying to, should we say, use the carrot, in other words, investment, to encourage the locals to stay loyal to the West, they seem to be trying to use the stick, sort of saying, well, if you do this deal with the Chinese, we're going to punish you.
Yeah, well, there is that. But I mean, they have been trying to kind of bribe them back because, I mean, even with Kiribati in the last 3 years, you know, they've been putting massive amounts of money into them. Still, you know, just last year, New Zealand sent aid to Kiribati of $33 million. You know, Australia did a similar amount and America was not far behind. And you know, that's just unbelievable amount of money when you consider the population of Kiribati. The whole island nation is only 130 odd thousand people, you know, so it's absolutely tiny. It's only, you know, an eighth or a quarter the size of sort of Bristol, I imagine, you know, so they are trying to bring them back into the fold, you know. So and just on Kiribati, I mean, I sent you an article not too long ago about China sending a missile from China into Kiribati waters. And just like you said, the positioning of it's interesting because, I mean, they are, you know, halfway between New Zealand and Hawaii there, and the Marshall Islands are between them and China. So the missile must have virtually gone over the Marshall Islands, which is obviously an American territory. And it is American territory where they supposedly keep the nuclear weapons in the Pacific, you know, so it's very interesting. And the missile they sent was actually a nuclear capable missile that China sent over the top of them. So, yeah, they must have been sweating inside the military base in the Marshall Islands, I imagine, when they sent that missile unexpectedly over the top of them.
So who do you think's reacting to who? Are the Americans reacting by trying to love bomb the islands with money to the Chinese approaches, or is it the other way around?
Well, I think, to be honest, is, you know, the Chinese, they're very interested in economic expansion, aren't they? And I don't think there's anything malicious particularly about it. It's you know, they're after, with Kiribati, the fishing rights. With the Cook Islands, they're after the deep sea mining rights, apparently. So it's about money, as most things are. But I think it's the Americans who are really trying to sort of, you know, get a bigger military presence in the region, using this expansion of Chinese economic growth as a kind of excuse, you know. And there are obviously parties, groups of people in the US who would love to get a war started in the Pacific. I'm sure, you know, you've got America building these nuclear submarines, you know, costing billions of dollars, and it's all designed to get something going in the Pacific, you know. So I think China are fairly innocent in the whole situation. They're interested in expansion, you know, in economic terms more than military terms, I'd say. But obviously America would love to take China down a peg or two, wouldn't they, in their economic expansion. So yeah, that's my theory of what's going on. And I've just been looking at a guy who's kind of stirring this all up, a guy called Peter Zeihan. And he's got a book out called The End of the World is Just the Beginning. You know, and this is the guy who's advising the New Zealand government on Pacific matters. He's also advising the US on Pacific matters. And he's got, you know, very good contacts in Washington. And he's making hundreds of thousands of dollars per year advising these governments. And I'm sure he's also advising some of these Pacific islands as well, you know, because he is a so-called expert on this. And he's very anti-China. You know, he believes that China will collapse, you know, within 30 seconds, kind of. And he's been saying this for 10 years. And if you go online, there are plenty of people debunking his statistics about China. You know, China is not going to collapse suddenly like he predicts, you know. And he's the one who is trying to shift New Zealand away from China, because obviously New Zealand's biggest trading partner is China. Everything New Zealand can produce, you know, milk, beef, sheep, everything they can produce, China will buy it. But he's telling them you need to diversify. He's trying to shift them to send their milk and stuff to India, you know, because he's telling them that, oh, China's just going to collapse and you're going to be screwed, you know. So, or he's telling them there's a coming war with China, you know, so you need to get away from China, you know. So at the moment, New Zealand, they want to be friends with China because they make a lot of money from China. But as soon as they move away from China and start selling to other countries, you know, they'll be like Australia. They'll be gunning for a kind of war, you know, I think, with China.
So that's Andy Gordon from Dunedin in New Zealand speaking to me the other day on the Pacific Islands and the sort of battle there. Martin, it seems pretty obvious the economic friendship is really the way to love bomb these countries into coming over to your side. If you do that sort of thing well, then the military sort of follows, doesn't it? And the idea that you're blocking out other superpowers if you've got a good economic relationship with these little islands.
Well, I think what the islands are trying to do is play one lot off against the other, you know. So, you know, you go to the Chinese and say, well, what have you got to offer us? And then you go to the Western powers and say, well, what have you got to offer us? And, you know, that's the game if you're a little country, isn't it, if you're a small place.
I like the idea of the end of the world is just the beginning. Because, you know, he's basically talking about saying China is extremely fragile, it's going to collapse, blah, blah, isn't he?
Well, I mean, there's some people who want that to happen. I mean, you know, my views on COVID, it was a deliberate attempt to try and smash the Chinese economy.
It's not going
to
happen. I mean, I think it's just a complete fantasy, this idea that China is going to just vanish in a puff of blue smoke.
Well, the people like David Stockman, who used to be Reagan's Office of Management and Budget, and he's a 9/11 truther, but he says it's a red Ponzi scheme, that in actual fact it's, you know, China will fail because it's just badly run by a lot of people who don't know what they're doing, etc. That's not Michael Hudson's view, not the view of most of sensible people I read. I read a couple of years ago now, When China rules the world. Now, if you think about it in historical terms, throughout most of recorded history, China was the most developed part of the world. It only became underdeveloped in the 19th century when the British and various others went in there and underdeveloped it. Before that, it was in fact the most advanced technologically, for example, most of the technical advances which allowed Europe to conquer the world were actually Chinese. So gunpowder, for example, invented in China. Yeah.
Do you have any truck with this theory that Chairman Mao was put there by Yale University, and his bookshops, his communist bookshops in the 1920s, were funded out of Yale?
Listen, the Americans tried to influence what was happening in China from the 19th century onwards. You know, the British were the first in there, but the Americans were in there as well.
I mean, weren't the Americans just sort of picking up a baton?
Yeah, but
the British have, interest is waning here. We're going to go in with a punch.
Well, I mean, don't forget, all of the imperialist powers at the Boxer Rebellion was against all foreigners in China. And of course, the Peking legation they were completely surrounded. That was Americans, Russians, Germans, Japanese, British, all inside the legation. When the Boxer Rebellion took place.
It's a bit of history we're not really very good on in our history here, are we? The whole history of the development of China, particularly the Mao, the revolution, what happened after the Second World War, and the nationalists, Chinese, all going to Taiwan. That whole history isn't really well known at all.
No, it's better known in Southeast Asia than it is here, for obvious reasons.
So what I will try and do, I will dig out this. I watched last year a very good documentary on China. I think it was a three-part US one, so I will endeavour to search that out. If I can, I'll put that up on our show page too. But to wind up tonight, we're going to be... Andy also wanted to talk about this thing called EACT, which is... Effective accelerationism, it's called. It's a particular brand of accelerationism coming out of Silicon Valley in the United States. He's saying actually some of these tech giants are really getting focused on how to change the world to their own advantage.
Has Musk sort of decided he's going to use Trump in order to get his way, or is it the other way around?
Yeah, well, I think that these Silicon Valley crowds, you know, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and so on, you know, the role I see them in is they're kind of Trump's, you know, kind of soothsayers, you know, because they are into the dark arts and so on. You know, they're into this EACT, you know, effective accelerationism and so on. And I think they're advising Trump in a way. And so they are, you know, they are in charge in a way, because, you know, he is listening to them and he thinks that they're wonderful, kind of, you know. So Trump's moved away from listening to the old crowd, maybe, you know, the CIA and deep state people, and he's moved on to these soothsayers of the Silicon Valley, you know. So that's how I see their role.
Well, this EACT sounds interesting. That's something I've not heard of before. What does it stand for again?
It stands for effective accelerationism. You know, so they are accelerationists, a bit like that Peter Zeihan. You know, I see him as a kind of accelerationist in the Pacific here. But yeah, this EACT is kind of a development from Nick Land's work, you know, your friend Nick Land there. And according to information I've seen on Nick Land, he loves the idea of this EACT accelerationism, because it's you know, they kind of worship him in some of these quarters. They see him as the god of this accelerationism. And you know, EACT is a kind of twist on the dark accelerationism which Nick Land was into, and it's more kind of this utopian version. They kind of believe that they should suck out more energy from nature. And they're deluded, because as of yet there's no technology to really capture this energy.
Well, that sounds like maybe using more fossil fuels or something. I mean, look, we've got to say something about Nick here, because, I mean, this idea of worship, you know, worshipping Nick, I know what you mean, because there seem to be a lot of people that think the sun shines out of his backside, basically, that he's really got it right in some way. But he's definitely, I mean, he certainly is the father of accelerationism, which is one of the main things driving, it seems, the philosophies driving many of the elites out there. So it's bizarre to have this as a sort of teenage schoolmate being behind this. He's now in Shanghai, which is the sort of new Manchester in a way, when that was the Industrial Revolution. It's Shanghai is the powerhouse of industrial China and financial China. So he obviously knows which side his bread is buttered.
I think some of these, you know, accelerationists, these effective accelerationists, you know, they were trying to turn Nick's ideas of the Dark Enlightenment, you know, kind of to a good perspective. But then I think that, you know, there's so many of these groups popping up in Silicon Valley, and it's become very fashionable to read Nick's book and other, you know, philosophers from France and so on that Nick was into. So they kind of do their homework and then they come up with their own version. And it's been picked up right by the top boys, you know, like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and Mark Andreessen's one of them. You know, he's a billionaire behind a lot of these Silicon Valley companies, and he's written his own EAC manifesto, you know. So and I think those people, the ones you really need to watch, these billionaires, they are kind of turning it back to a darker sort of version of accelerationism. You know, so, I mean, and they see Nick as a kind of god. And I don't know, what do you think? I mean, you knew him when he was young. What was he like when he was young? Is he some kind of god or well, some genius? Or what is he?
What is he? Well, if you're interested in my answer, you can have a listen to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. No, Nick is not a god. Of course not. He was an incredibly knowledgeable guy. And when he was age 14, you know, he knew more than anyone else in our school, particularly the masters at the school, at this grammar school. But anyway, Martin, this is interesting, isn't it? There seemed to be this belief in technology, a belief in AI. You can see why they call it the Dark Enlightenment. Technology was did feature in the original Enlightenment massively, didn't it?
It did, but of course it was also, the original Enlightenment was also about humanistic values and caring about people and you know, trying to liberate people from you know, the shackles of the past. Varoufakis has got a book out at the moment called Techno-Feudalism.
Good, yeah.
Because he's saying capitalism is dead and we've now got techno-feudalism.
He's right, I think.
And of course it's actually based on rent. You see, a lot of these companies don't make any profits, no. Like Tesla. And they don't make any profits. What they do is they're dependent on share values, which is effectively, a relationship to the real economy.
We had a bit of a whoopsie daisy, didn't we, the other week with the Chinese AI company knocking billions and billions, hundreds of billions off the value of AI shares from Silicon Valley.
Well, that is the nightmare for Silicon Valley, isn't it?
The nightmare for us, and of course, this is why the Enlightenment is dark. This is actually, it's a very quick final clip, but it's one of the interviews that I played a couple of weeks ago on here, and it's with the present day Science and Technology Minister, Peter Kyle, who happens to be a former boyfriend of Ivor Kaplan. Martin, I'm sure you are aware of that what's been happening with Ivor Kaplan, aren't you?
I don't even know who Ivor Kaplan is.
Ivor Kaplan, no, well, okay, so I'll tell you. Ivor Kaplan has been caught in a sting trying to meet up at Brighton Railway Station with a schoolboy by some vigilantes down there, and he's been filmed and the information, and then he was arrested. Now, Ivor Kaplan's a former minister, right. Armed Forces Minister, Labour Party, Zionist. In fact, he's very, very pro-Zionist. In fact, he was one of the people that was organising to get Jeremy Corbyn booted out of the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. So, former boyfriend of Peter Kyle, who you're about to hear now, who is now Science and Technology Minister under Starmer. And the reason I'm replaying this is because of what I think it's Matt Chorley, who used to be on Times Radio. He's now on 5 Live weekday afternoons. And here he is interviewing Peter Kyle about AI, and what he says at the end is absolutely, I think, brilliant.
And tell me then about the AI tool being used in government by officials, Humphrey, named after Sir Humphrey Appleby from Yes Minister, who spent his entire time using a word salad to disguise what was really going on.
Yes, well, you've cunningly, because you are so embedded into the Whitehall life, found out the internal nickname that we've given to a suite of different productivity tools. We, as a digital centre of government in the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology, are devising, programming, engineering and deploying AI products and services in a safe and fully tested way to drive efficiencies within government. It's not one product that's called Humphrey, there's a series of them. And if I give you one example, there's a product called Consult. And Consult uses, it's able to analyze all of the legislation going back hundreds of years, all of the regulatory landscapes and rules that regulators have. And when ministers want to get to understand, to make a change in the law or a change in regulations or even just make an announcement, Consult can look at all of this information and within minutes do what it takes weeks for a civil servant to do, because just imagine the amount of time. So it can deliver it 1,000 times faster than a human being can, and it can do so 400 times more cheaply than a human can. So we're talking about something that currently takes, you can do in 52 hours, that currently with human beings would take 6 years to do. That's the scale of ambition we have as a government. And that is the kind of product that it comes under the Humphrey umbrella that we're using internally.
Is there a risk then that all you need to do is put an AI voice on the end of that and we can do away with ministers?
Well, wouldn't that be wonderful? And I'll be you can't see me at the moment, Matt, so you don't even know if it is me you're talking to.
But that is true.
So that's Peter Carr admitting that he could be an AI bot. Now, this seems to me to be what the Dark Enlightenment's kind of all about, Martin, is the idea is to switch government over to AI. He calls this all about implementing productivity tools in the Cabinet Office, and then we don't really need anyone involved as MPs making policy. The government can just get on with it.
Well, interestingly enough, the Chinese are very much at the cutting edge of robotics, and they've created factories in China which are entirely robotic factories with no workers at all. The problem underlying all of this, as was pointed out by Marx and Engels in the 19th century, is capitalism unleashes the productive forces of society to a situation where ultimately you don't need any workers at all. So the workers have actually got to take over capitalism if they're going to survive, because capitalism basically gets rid of workers, and in getting rid of workers, it's getting rid of the people who buy the stuff that capitalism produces, because robots don't need to eat. They don't need to buy anything. And of course, this fundamental problem is what causes crashes and crises in capitalism, and the massive increase in productivity created by AI, if it can be made to work, because of course it consumes huge amounts of energy, although the Chinese version looks as if it can consume a lot less energy, but there's still a fundamental problem. As the labour power is pushed out of the workforce, out of the, you know, then the capitalism goes into a crisis.
Well, we already know that in warfare, so for example in Ukraine, using the Palantir AI system to target and kill Russians, it's quite handy to take the human element out of a battlefield situation. There's no, the same exact thing that's been going on in Gaza, using the same sort of technology. I think, isn't it called Lavender or something, the Israeli AI that's been killing people in Gaza? Yeah. Once you've taken the human element out, then anything can happen. There's no morality, there's no there's actually no value of human life whatsoever. What happens when that is transposed into government?
Well, I mean, it's not just government, it's business and warfare. It's all
government policy and implementing policy in government, you know, with no human element.
Yes, but I mean, ultimately, what's allowed use of technology in the Ukraine is because, in actual fact, there's been a gentleman's agreement not to shoot the satellites down. But of course, if we come to a full-on war, what the Russians will do is knock out Starlink.
just be gone. Anyway, I will put a link up to the book Andy was talking about by, I can't remember the guy's name, but the EACT Accelerationists, and some of the notes to do with that on our show page later at this week or over the weekend at wistheweek.org.uk. Thanks very much to particularly to the guest Roy Pomfrey from Stop Hinkley, also to John Bosnich, as well as, of course, Andy Gordon there in New Zealand, and to Joe Banks. We've got quite a lot of guests this week. The freelance journalist here talking about property developers and the genocidalists building property, massive multi-storey student flats here in Bristol, as well, of course, as Matt O'Brannan taking on the Israelis in Trafalgar Square, as well, of course, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Thanks, everybody. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, which includes the podcast, the full-length interviews. The Bosnich one is particularly mind-blowing. I would definitely recommend that this week. And the story links and a comment page as well there. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. And if you can afford it, you can donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk, either to PayPal or to our actual bank account. And so this show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. And do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, also at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. You can find that. Just go to the thisweek.org.uk page, just below the big green button. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down. Thank you.
ones who start to mold a new reality closer to the heart, closer to the heart. Blacksmith and the artist reflected in their art. They forge their creativity closer to the heart. Yes, closer to the heart. Philosophers and plowmen each must know his part to sow a new mentality closer to the heart. Yes, closer to the heart. Yeah!
You do. Smile for the camera, join the queue. First on the right, where we'll fingerprint you. Then we'll have a little chat, you and me, a conversation. All I want's a bit of information. We can keep you into Monday if you want it that way. So it's up to you, son. Okay, anything you say will be taken down and stored on the computer. And used to persecute you. In the future, we know you're involved, cause you may stop you in luck. There's no point you denying it. The sooner you tell us who organised it, the sooner we can put you away, okay? Okay. Not okay, there's another place behind another locked door. It stinks too, cause it's piss on the floor, but it says on the wall, in felt pen scroll, all coppers are scabs and there's no law of the land. All the rich bastards in command. Margaret Thatcher making her dirty work is getting done. The police are dancing to a tune, beating time with the truncheons. And if they got ordered to shoot you, what do you think they'd do? Unless they chucked it in as a bad job, refused to be a cop, and they'd shoot you. I got United Kingdom Company Police, State Blues, Conservative Party Political Broadcast Police, State Blues. Margaret Thatcher saying, to Police State Blues. Margaret Thatcher's Third Reich Police State Blues. Them blues are coming down heavy on our heads. Can anyone hear me say we're not done for yet? I'd rather be a spanner than a cog, and I'd rather be a freak than a cog. I got the Summer Times, the News of the World Police State Blues. Neil Kinnock's diluted shit Police State Blues. British troops in Northern Ireland Police State Blues. British money in South Africa Police State Blues. Roadblock here, roadblock there Police State Blues. Riot police everywhere Police State Blues. thanks for listening.